Heroes such as King Heinrich, known on account of his love of birds as Heinrich the Fowler. This man was one of several of whom Heinrich the Fowlest, Himmler, believed himself to be a reincarnation. Promoting the Lebensborn project for the breeding of pure Germanic stock, Himmler said, "When conception takes place in a Nordic cemetery, the child will inherit the spirit of the dead heroes who are buried there." Lists of suitable sex cemeteries were published in the Schwarzer Korps, the SS's periodical. The German dead, it seems, are always with us. And Nazism was nothing if not a death cult. It glorified death, from which it promised return.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Friday the 7th of July 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol and on the talkradio.org.uk stream, as well as radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the app, the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Anything please but Google. Give it a go if you haven't already installed it. I'd love to promise that there's no spyware on it, but Nick has assured me there's not. Who knows? If you download it from the Google store, there might be. Who knows? But on our website at thisweek.org.uk, you'll find a link to a non-Google store. And also, of course, it's available from the Apple store. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda, the psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, cancelling vote winners like Boris and Trump, while Big Pharma's Matt Hancock and Bill Gates' crimes against humanity are all supposed to have been forgotten now, because it's all been subsumed by the evil Putin. So, the accelerationist cults are now waging open war on the British people, as well as on Putin himself. So this is what the BBC might sound like if it hadn't been occupied by the Zionist lobby after its takeover by Victor Rothschild and Margaret Thatcher, and Marmaduke Hussey's intervention back in 1987, helping us navigate us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week in part one, looking at the Competition and Markets Authority has decided that the supermarkets have been price fixing. So what are they going to do about it? They're going to say, oh, well, slap on the wrist, please don't do it again. Please, please, pretty please. And what you're going to have to do is do some sort of digital thing, another wonderful app probably, which will help people to know how much you're charging in different parts of the city, so you can weave this into Waze or Google Maps or whatever, and you can just say, find me. You can say to your phone, find me the nearest cheap petrol, and it will take you there. So no penalty at all for the supermarkets for price fixing. No surprises there from this Goldman Sachs government. And also Starmer, the leader of the opposition, the records of his trips to the US to see the Department of Justice over two cases, the Julian Assange case and the Gary McKinnon case, guess what? They've all been stuck in the shredder. How about that? When he was Director of Public Prosecutions, that is. This week, or actually today, just a quick announcement, almost no commentary on it so far I've seen, is house prices down 2.6% in June, the biggest fall since 2011. Oh dear. Doesn't look like the economy is going anywhere, does it? Farmer protests in Spain and Holland this week. To begin with, we'll be looking at the bank account cancellation of Nigel Farage and others. In part two, obviously focusing on Jenin, the atrocities, the war crimes, the apartheid by the Israelis goes on. But we obviously, being fair and balanced, we're going to have we're going to hear from the former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett to see what he's got to say about why it's okay for the Israeli Defense Force to go charging in with bulldozers, killing children, and sending the army armed to the teeth into these civilian areas, refugee camp, in fact. Also, an exclusive with Christian Hrafnason, the new editor of WikiLeaks, who took over from Julian Assange. He has got some very interesting theories about why, in 2010, why the Americans went for Julian, and why the British went for him too. Obviously, Keir Starmer involved very much in all that. So, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, then a few days after by Ofcom. We cancelled off Bristol Community FM by Pat Hart and the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. So, Martin, should we start, as I said we would do, with this whole idea of people being cancelled by having their bank accounts taken out? Nigel Farage announced all this last week, but he's not the first, is he? In fact, I think it was around about 2015, 2016, we first reported accounts of Palestinian campaigns that were charities that had their bank accounts closed by HSBC. So this increasingly seems to be a tool the banks are using when they've got some sort of political opposition. They're just pressing the close the account button.
Well, I think they just certainly do occasion. Well, you know, as you say, the Palestinian case is a fairly obvious one of politicisation of banking decisions.
Funnily enough, Nigel Farage hasn't really been talking about that, but so he's not the first. But this idea of being able to cancel people by closing their bank accounts, this is being warned of for quite a while, particularly in relation to the Great Reset. People saying, well, actually, this is the banks kind of moving in and taking control. And in fact, of course, the banks have set up themselves a new form of currency called a central bank digital currency that they are this is through the Bank for International Settlements and other big central banks. They're trying to slowly push this onto the world to have these central bank digital currencies, programmable currencies.
Yes, and that's an issue. But I think what the Coutts, which is the bank we're talking about, is a very elite bank. You have to have loads of money. I haven't got a bank account in Coutts, and I don't suppose you have.
I can't possibly comment.
Well, there we are. Maybe you have, Danny. The thing is that private banks are under no obligation to treat their customers fairly if they decide they want to close you.
Okay, what you're implying
said,
here,
he hadn't got enough money in the account.
Well, I don't know if you've seen this, Martin. Maybe you don't listen to other outlets, but there was three or four people, literally contacted the press to say, well, I've got less than X amount of money in my Coutts bank account, and they haven't spoken to me at all. So, you know, it is quite likely that Farage has been... I mean, it seems to me to be an excuse the bank has put out. Oh, by the way, it's us, it's Coutts, and, oh, he hasn't got enough money in his account, so this is perfectly regular and perfectly normal. But, of course, it isn't really, is it? I know,
If the banking system was publicly owned, you'd be in a position to say that that was unfair because everybody should be treated
equally.
But actually,
what about the law?
It's not.
Doesn't the law say that you have to give a bank account?
No. Banks are private organisations.
Well, there have been cases where
people don't have to justify anything they do to anybody.
The banks have threatened to close people's account, and they have actually taken the bank to court, and they've had to restore the account.
Well, it depends on what, I would argue...
A private company cannot just simply do what it wants. It's not above the law.
No, it's not above the law, but they could argue that this causes reputational damage to us. This is what they argued about the Palestinian charities, and ultimately, they own
what about
the bank,
the other way around?
They don't want to give you a bank account, you can't.
Well, what about the other way around? Well, maybe you can, actually. What about the other way around? If it's causing you reputational damage to have your bank account closed?
Well, in that case, you can sue them.
Yeah.
But, of course, you have to have a load of money to do that.
It'll be interesting to see how the courts deal with this. Certainly, over the years, there's been some... there have been successful cases where people have taken... But, of course, what they were discussing this on talk radio earlier on, someone called in and said, well, the trouble is that they're trying to pick people off one by one. And the idea that people can get together and have a big class action and sue HSBC, it's very, very unlikely.
Well, it is. And, people all over the world have all sorts of repressions inflicted on them, including denial of access to bank accounts and all sorts of other things. It's noteworthy in this case because Nigel Farage is a well-known figure on the right of British politics. But in actual fact, it's normal practice. People use all sorts of methods in political struggles. We know this. There's everything from
people or private banks.
Private banks are involved in political struggles. They've got their own agenda.
Well, I think they've
and
got.
And they may have decided that they're going to, you know, direct this at Nigel Farage.
Cash in these chips.
Coutts is an elite bank run by elite people. And if they decide that they don't want him, then they decide they don't want him.
A lot of the people who've been cancelled are not, you know, HSBC an elite bank? It's probably much bigger, actually, than Coutts.
Yes. It is.
They've been cancelling people. But
well,
anyway,
that's right.
Maybe
the banking system should be owned by the state. And
let
then we
me
could
put
really,
to you
really
why
insist.
Why I think Nigel Farage has been being cancelled by the banks because he's kind of given up a bit on Brexit. I think he was a few months ago. He actually said, Brexit's a complete failure. I might even leave the country. Well, obviously, a lot of the Remainers will be very pleased about that. But he's, over the last few weeks, taken up a new campaign to do with central bank digital currencies.
They're coming for your money. The government, the Bank of England, and the financial powers that be. They're hatching a plan, already in motion, to take more control of at least some of your money. Rishi Sunak calls it Britcoin, and yes, he's a big fan of it. In fact, he seems to be something of a cheerleader for this track-and-trace technology. It's something that is being trialled or developed in over 100 countries around the world. Unsurprisingly, China is leading the way. Make no mistake, this is about surveillance. This is about monitoring you in a new and disturbing way. I think you've probably heard of a central bank digital currency before. It's been all over the news just recently. But I'd wager you don't know the full story. I don't think anyone has walked you through it in a calm and sensible way. That's just what we're going to do here today, because I'm worried that a lot of people, perhaps you, could be caught unawares by just how invasive and Orwellian this new form of digital money could turn out to be. You'll be told about all the benefits, the convenience, about how it's a more secure way to make a transaction. You'll get all the spin. But let me speak plainly. The risk here is that you could be penalized financially, using too much energy, eating too much meat, supporting the wrong causes. Well, central bank digital currencies would make it very easy to steer you in the right direction. Incredibly, the Chancellor came out recently to say that you won't even be able to save your own money in the form of this planned new digital currency. He calls it hoarding. But shouldn't you be the one to decide what you do with it? Isn't it yours, after all? I'm here today to separate the fact from fiction and the wild conspiracies from the very real threat CBDCs may pose to your rights and freedoms. I'm sad to say there may be no stopping it. Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak look determined to move forward with this radical type of new financial surveillance. But there is something you can do to limit the threat it poses you. You need to do something. There are steps you can take now to move at least some of your investment capital and money beyond their reach, assets that ring-fence your wealth from the dangers of CBDCs. In the video that follows, we'll share details on those steps. If you've heard about this new form of money and you're skeptical about it, what it all means, well, if you sense there's more at play here than just the official government line, keep watching. I've asked my colleague Nick Hubble to show you what's really happening behind the headlines and what you can do about it before it's too late.
Thanks, Nigel. For the first time in half a century, the British authorities are preparing to issue a new currency. And if you have any money in a British bank account, you need to know
Thanks,
how
Nick.
It works.
Thanks, Nigel. Thanks, Nigel. Anyway, it's interesting. This came out about 3 weeks ago, which is a campaign by something called the Fleet Street Letter. Nigel Farage, it's part of something called South Bank Research. Apparently the Fleet Street Letter has been being published. It's they claim it's the oldest investment letter in Britain, and was founded 73 years ago. So anyway, this is something which Farage is part of, but it may be simply that this has been doing the rounds, been doing quite well. A lot of people have been subscribing to their letter. I think it's the basic version of it is something like £100 a year. Obviously, it's aimed at people with savings. A lot of people don't have savings, but this may have irked them.
It may have done. It's possible. As I say, Coutts may have decided that because he's going to campaign against central bank digital currency, which they're in favour of, they're going to close his bank account. And as I say, under free market capitalism, Coutts can do that, unless we're going to have a nationalised banking system, as I said earlier.
As I said also, we're going around in circles here a little bit, but it is quite feasible that the justification for it may be questioned in court. And anyway, it's Nigel Farage is not the only person by any means that's been cancelled. And I was interested to see earlier on this week that pro-cash campaigner Debbie Hicks used to live in Stroud. She's now, I think, in Wiltshire, but she's certainly in the south of England. Goes all around the country campaigning to keep it cash, putting her little leaflets around and doing talks to explain what these central bank digital currencies cryptocurrencies are all about and the power of the banksters. She's very concerned about it all. And I spoke to her earlier this week about how she'd had her bank accounts cancelled. By the way, that thing we just heard from Farage, I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, as I will with the full version of this clip from the interview with Debbie Hicks you're about to hear.
We had a joint account, me and my husband, with, like a current account we use every day with HSBC. The worst bank I know, it's absolutely the worst one for all this. And about a month ago, my card was rejected at several cash points. And I was at, sometimes that does happen. Different cash points don't work, etc. So when it happened the first time, I didn't sort of take any notice. But then after a few occasions, I thought, oh, something's going on here. So I didn't get home till late. The next day, my husband phoned HSBC, and as you know, you get through to some call center overseas and it's very, very hard. And they said, yes, the card's been frozen, not the account at that point, the card's been frozen because Mrs. Hicks, and this is how strange it was. It was all about me, even though I've got a joint account. Mrs. Hicks withdraws a lot of cash and it's flagged up our fraud team. It's been flagged up to them. It's come up as an issue that we've had to freeze it. I said to my husband, because he always phones them up if there's a problem, he sort of complained and he said, okay, don't worry, we'll unfreeze that straight away. He explained that I'm a big cash user and I use cash and there's nothing suspicious in it. So we thought, oh, that's okay. Next day, my husband went onto his banking app because he does online banking. I don't do it, but he's got an app on his phone. And he said, the banking app's been frozen. I said, oh, why have they done that? So I said, oh, you better phone them up. So he phoned them up again. And they said, to be honest, I don't think they had a clue on the phone because I think it was way beyond them at that level what was going on. And they said, we don't know why that's happened, but we have got on the file that a letter was sent to Mrs. Hicks, so it's about me again, to Mrs. Hicks with some security questions that she never responded to. Now, we never got a letter, Tony. We have moved house. They said it was sent to our previous address, but we have everything on a redirection. So it didn't seem likely that we missed that. Nothing came through to us. And they said, so that is why we froze the accounts. And so I said to my husband, well, hold on. It was about cash yesterday and now it's about a letter not being answered. This is really strange. And again, okay, sorry about this. We'll unfreeze the account. Again, next day, so this was Monday, this was all over the weekend. Monday, account still frozen. And so we're getting really concerned now. Phone up again. And it's something different this time, Tony. And this time, Mrs. Hicks has to, we've too many security issues now and we can't unlock this account. She needs to go into a branch with ID and verify that she is who she is. And it's like, oh, for goodness sake, I've had this account for years, always use this. Why do I need to do this? Okay, I'll go in. So I went into, I think it was Monday, I went into, this was about a month ago now, I went into HSBC in Swindon because that's the nearest one that has staff in to where I live, because as we've just talked about, there's no banks anymore. And how can I put this politely? Staff absolutely, absolutely useless, like a chocolate teapot. I mean, really, it's not like years ago where you had a bank manager that was kind of in charge and knew what was going on. Really just administrative staff that haven't got a clue. And I sat there in the office with this young man for about an hour, and he really just, which is the problem we've got with everything these days, was really just reading off the stuff off the screen to me. He wasn't dealing with any of my complaints. So I went through it all with him and he took my ID and I said, I want an explanation. What is going on? I said, I've got all these contradictory reasons why our account's been frozen. I want to know what's going on, why it's been frozen. And then he pulled up some banking policy from HSBC and he claimed that because when we moved house, my husband did it, changed the address for our joint account. He said that because I didn't also contact the bank to say that I had moved as well, this was why it had all been frozen. I said, well, hold on. Over the last few days, you've given me three other explanations. So he pulled it up on the screen and I said, well, why is it then that you've taken a year, because this was over a year ago that we moved, and you've taken a year to flag this up that I didn't change the address. And, you know, we've had accounts with you for years, a joint account, and it's never been an issue before when just one of us changes it. So he said, well, look, read it here. So he turns the screen round to me, Tony, and this is how Orwellian it all is. And the statement on the screen, the HSBC policy, actually says the opposite. And I'm reading it out. It actually says only one person from the joint account has to change, can change the details. And I'm reading it out to him and he's like, no. And I'm like, oh, my God, what is this? This is, I felt like I was in a scene from 1984. It's saying something different to what he's telling me. So we're going around in circles and circles and I'm not getting a satisfactory answer. And of course, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, this is about me, isn't it? And who I am. But of course, they're not going to. And to be honest, I don't think he even knew any of that kind of information. It was just at that level. It's administrative, isn't it? Like it is in any organisation. I don't think he really knew what was going on. So anyway, I got very angry and I said, look, I want to withdraw all my cash from this bank. Why should you have my money after what you've done to me? You've stopped my access to my own money. You've treated me like a criminal. You've made me try and jump through hoops. I said, you know, I want to take all my cash out. So I managed to get all the cash out and I said, I want to close the account down. And he said that was fine. And went back to my husband and said, look, we need to immediately try and open up another account. But until we could do that, we had to make sure the other account was open to move, you know, sort of payments that we make, bills, etc., over. So a month later, and this is where I'm getting really worried now as well. We've been trying to open up a co-op account. Maybe that's a bad choice. I think it is now. And we're still waiting and I'm really concerned now that there's a problem. But the problem we still got, Tony, is that the account is still frozen. We still can't, luckily we've got other accounts that we managed to get, you know, so we're just about surviving. But this HSBC account is still, and he'd even told me on that day, he'd unlocked it all, this is how insane it all is, it's still frozen. We still can't do anything with it and we're still waiting for a co-op account to, even though we've settled the ID off.
Well, I mean, there's a few things here. I mean, first of all, it seems quite clear that somebody at HSBC has decided to gaslight you or just simply lie to you about and try to get you to voluntarily leave by coming out with all sorts of different lies about why they don't want your account. And most importantly, have you actually got the money that was in HSBC? Is it now out and in your hands?
Well, I managed to withdraw the cash that day. He allowed me to do that on that day. But even though obviously there's, I don't know, whatever it is to keep the account open, there's a little bit of money still left in there, which I had to keep to try and transfer to the co-op with all the other things going on. We still can't use the account. The online banking is frozen, so my husband can't access that. And we've got no cards because they froze the cards and they haven't. And they promised us they were going to send us new ones and they haven't replaced them. So we both, and that's my husband as well now, he can't use it either. So the whole account is now not, I mean, it was me to start with, but now the whole account is frozen. So I'm just hoping the co-op account, there's no easy choices with this, but I knew that co-op was more cash friendly, so I went for a co-op account. But I'm now hearing that, I don't know if you've heard the news, that Louise Creffield, who does Save Our Rights, has just put up a post, was it today or yesterday? And she's had exactly the same happen to her, Tony. And that was with co-op as well. She's had her account that she uses for Save Our Rights has been frozen and her private personal account has been frozen. So it's happening to so many people now.
So that's Debbie Hicks, full version of that up on our show page tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Yeah, it's obviously not just Nigel Farage this is happening to, Martin. I mean, this isn't being kind of officially reporting in press releases by the banks, you know, where we have decided that all these types of people, we're going to close their accounts. But what we're doing is we're hearing about it. And Louise Creffield from Save Our Rights, she was one of the organisers of one of the first big demonstrations during the lockdown in Trafalgar Square, for example. So, I mean, you may not agree with the campaigning position of these people, but surely it's not right for the banks to be going around picking out these people and taking them out one by one.
I remember that some while ago we had an interview with, it was a business person, wasn't he? He was running a media company and he had his bank accounts frozen. Can you remember what I'm talking about? Because he was having very similar problems and it was causing him huge difficulties. And you interviewed him. I can't remember who what his name was. Well, you hear horror stories about how banks treat people all the time, don't you?
You do. I mean, you know, piling on all sorts of charges when they shouldn't do. But actually, closing down someone's account, what you're doing there is you're causing them enormous amounts of disruption. It's almost like launching a court case against somebody or something. So what you're doing is you're wasting their time. And also, so stopping them being able to actually go out and buy food and things like that. It means, I don't know what Debbie's situation is, but sounds to me like she might have had to put loads of cash under the mattress. I mean, this is very a primitive sort of way to do things, isn't it?
It is. Well, the banking system, as we know, is, a grotesque, insult to human intelligence. The whole setup is completely wrong.
Is there anywhere except totally China informed. Where actually banking is treated like a utility and it's very much controlled by the state?
Well, I think in China, as you know, but of course this is where they're bringing in this central bank digital currency. The Chinese approach to this is that we don't want people using because of course all these bitcoins and other coins have turned out to be an extremely dangerous
The idea is that this is something which is sort of a guaranteed version of Bitcoin run by the state.
So in other words, the state, on a similar sort of technology. Are coming forward and saying, right, instead of having this kind of Wild West Bitcoin scenario, we will do cryptocurrency, but we will do it. And if you put your money in the crypto yuan, it will be, we'll have the full backing of the People's Bank of China, etc.
Well, we spoke to Nick Corbishley, the writer, about all this, and he was very concerned. I think he's living out in Spain now as a UK journalist, and he's written a whole book about the central bank digital currencies. He says effectively what it does is it creates a kind of caste system, very much like the Chinese social credit system, where certain types of spending can be prohibited. So, for example, we might say Martin Summers is not allowed to go on a train, he's only allowed to go on a bus, and Tony Gosling is allowed to go on a plane, but Martin isn't. All these sorts of silly things where you get profiled and then what you're allowed to spend your money on is determined by the central bank.
Well, the central bank digital currency in China, I believe, is being developed. They're not saying it's compulsory. They're saying you can use it, and we're putting this in play as an alternative to the other, cryptocurrencies which you can use, which are also extremely dodgy. You can lose your money quite easily.
Well,
that doesn't mean that everybody has to use it. In actual fact, it's probably only high wealth and income individuals who might want to use it. So I think there's going to be a reform of the financial system. There has to be. And because of the technology, it is going to include some digital money, but we shouldn't get rid of cash. There should be a variety of fungible forms of money which can be exchanged into each other and used for different purposes.
Okay, well, let's go back to 2014. I did mention this Palestinian business, and people easily forget, actually, HSBC was at the centre of a scandal back then. The writer Peter Oborne wrote for the Daily Telegraph. His column was about the closing down of bank accounts by HSBC. He then wrote an article for the BBC about it, which they published. HSBC Muslims and Me is on BBC Radio. That was in 2015, but it was about events that had been taking place the year before. And at the time, it was there on the iPlayer. So the article is, why did HSBC shut down bank accounts? So this was something that was due to be published in The Telegraph by Peter Oborne, the columnist, and then the editors decided not to use it. And Peter Oborne, he was the associate editor of The Spectator, resigned from The Daily Telegraph after the newspaper refused to publish an article about HSBC's closure of accounts. But in a way, more interesting is which accounts had been closed. It was the Finsbury Park Mosque account and several other prominent Muslims in Britain who had their accounts closed. Now, the thing I note about this, Martin, is that actually Finsbury Park Mosque, although it was where people like Abu Hamza and various other people involved with the 7/7 bombings were active, the mosque itself, which account was closed, these were the people who were phoning up the Metropolitan Police saying, we've got dodgy people infiltrating our mosques. Will you please come and and sort them out, interrogate, arrest them or something, or get them out of our mosque. So the people who are actually dobbing in the terrorists are the ones who had their accounts closed back in 2014. And maybe that's why Peter O'Bourne found himself not being allowed by the Telegraph to publish the article.
Well, I think what's the, in the case of these Palestinian accounts and so on, it's clearly Zionist lobbying of HSBC that's behind it, and they are going along with it. And don't forget, we've just had passed in the Parliament this week a law in Britain banning local authorities or public bodies from any kind of boycott campaign against Israel. They are, this is lawfare, isn't it? That's what it is. It's lawfare. And they're very active. UK Lawyers for Israel, as you know, are very active. They took our little show to Ofcom some years ago, and they spend an awful lot of time going after the people they regard as their enemies, and they use all the thing, you know, all the levers that they can pull. I mean, we need to reform the banking system. It's interesting that the lady earlier was saying that she's going to go to the co-op. I mean, the whole concept of the cooperative bank was it was going to be, you know, a different kind of a bank, etc. But of course, it then went down the drain and is now owned by an American hedge fund, even though it tries to. I'm a member of the cooperative bank. They still try to claim to have an ethical policy on this, that, and the other, but they're effectively just another bank now.
Yeah, it was
now,
ultimately, a leveraged buyout.
We're going to have to the banks are actually insolvent. And when the crash comes, they're all going to be bankrupt, anyway, like the banks in California, and they'll all have to be nationalised, and we'll have to remake the whole system. Now, once the banks are nationalised, you can have a rule that says you're not allowed to discriminate against people putting their money in the bank on any political grounds at all. But if it's a private bank run by private shareholders with their private interests, ultimately capitalism is about people discriminating against people they don't like. They can do that. They can do that, and you can't stop them.
But yes, you can stop them, because the people they don't like can get together and do class actions against these banks. I think that's what's going to be coming down the line.
Sometimes you can try that, but ultimately, obviously,
there's an attempt here by the banks to do a divide and rule tactic, isn't there? Well, picking people off one by one. Okay, we'll do a few Muslims here, see how we get on. Let's do a few pro-cash campaigners now and see how we get on. The idea is that they're spacing this out over a long period of time to stop these people getting together. To take them to court together.
Well, that's right. Well, obviously, they're picking on different sets of people as well. You know, would the Palestinian rights campaigners want to have a class action with Farage? Quite possibly not, and he possibly wouldn't want to do it with them. So you can see what the issues are. Ultimately, in a capitalist society, capitalist entrepreneurs are not obliged to service you. They can say, I'm not serving you. Like people who run pubs say, I'm not serving you, you've got to leave the premises. This is the way it works.
But then they suffer reputational damage as a result, only if it's reported. But anyway, I was really surprised that there was no reporting of the fact that, at all, I didn't see anywhere reporting in any of the national press, the fact that Farage a few weeks ago started to front this anti-central bank digital currencies campaign. But anyway, with the Bank of England now firmly in charge of everything, you know, with even the Treasury not allowed to have any say in controlling interest rates, my own view, and I hear it echoed all over the place these days, is that the idea of cranking up interest rates is doing nothing to help the economy. In fact, what it's doing is it is crashing the housing market, and once the housing market starts to crash, all the balance sheets start to look dodgy of the individual businesses, the property balance sheets start to look dodgy, and they could end up by cranking interest rates up as they're doing, so-called to save the economy, doing the total opposite.
Dave's in London. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Yeah, good, sir. What do you want to say?
Mortgage crisis.
Yeah.
It's wrong on so many levels what they're doing. This inflation is supply side. It doesn't matter how much you put up the interest rates, it's not going to change the cost of producing a tin of beans.
Yeah.
Because it's to do with energy costs and everything else.
Yeah.
Only 28% of homes are under a mortgage, 35% of the population. So if the objective is to get demand down, which is silly because it's supply side in the first place,
yeah,
you're hammering 35% of people. The other 65% don't have a mortgage, right. So it's not going to impact them at all. You're sucking millions out of the economy that should be funding growth. I should be spending my money on interest rates. I should be putting in some new kitchen stuff and bathrooms and getting plumbers working and everything else. But that's all going.
But which you can't do because you're spending too much on the mortgage. But what do you think they think is the reason for putting up the interest rates to mortgage holders?
I honestly don't think that there is anyone in government anymore that understands maths or understands the dynamics of what's going on. People keep going on about the Bank of England and saying, why didn't they act earlier? Why aren't they doing more? There are 9 unelected people. They will meet for lunch this afternoon. And the only tool they have is, do we increase rates? Do we keep them the same or do we reduce them?
Yeah.
I mean, how long over lunch does that really take? And then they'll say, we better put the interest rates up because that's what we're expected to do. I believe the banks knew this inflation figure 3 days ago, hence why they were pulling all the mortgages. But you are hammering people with mortgages. All these people have just taken on mortgages to buy a house and now being completely crucified by, and it clearly doesn't work. If you've raised them 13 times, how many more times? What are we, 14, 15, 16? And it just goes on and on. And for one, I am a lifelong Tory voter. I swear on my mother's life, I will never vote for them ever again, purely because and only because of what they're doing with these mortgages.
Yeah.
Even the Labour guy, who's the annoying Labour guy, Richard, forgotten his name.
From I know the guy,
Yeah, you know the guy that's quite annoying.
Yeah.
Even he has come out and said, this doesn't work, it's a blunt tool, we should stop doing it. Now, I'm not going to vote at the next election, but if Labour keep making these noises, I will switch to Labour.
Well, here's the thing, though. Don't you think the Bank of England, of course, the government in their defence would say, yeah, but it's nothing to do with us. The mortgage rate gets put up, the interest rate gets put up by the Bank of England. And the Bank of England, in my view, were very, very lax and very, very kind of negligent, if you like, in keeping the interest rate so artificially low for such a long time. Because they lulled people into this false sense of security that you would always have a low interest rate and that your mortgage would always be relatively cheap. Well, it hasn't always been like that historically.
No, I know, but let's be honest. No one taking out a mortgage 18 months ago, if you'd have said to them, hey, do you know what? There'll be 14 consecutive months of rising. No one would do that. It's because of the war in Ukraine. And what I also don't like is, if the government have outsourced the interest rates to the Bank of England, they basically it's a bit like, if I was a CEO of a company, it's a bit like me outsourcing my currency hedging department to someone else.
Yeah.
They've outsourced it so they can just sit there and blame the Bank of England. Governments can intervene and deal with this. No other country does this.
Well, I mean, it's all very well. I mean, what I would say about the way that the government's been running the economy as well is that you can have an independent Bank of England, you can have interest rates controlled by them, but when you start introducing bucket loads of free money that you're suddenly inventing, that kind of changes the whole model, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not just about inflation and interest rates. You've got to think about growth as well. It's almost like, I just don't think Jeremy Hunt, I think he just runs from pillar to post. You can tell there's nothing going on inside his head. His brain is going around at 1 mile an hour. He can't multitask. And this is an absolute disaster waiting to happen. This is going to take growth out of this country for the next 5 to 10 years at least.
Yeah. No, I think they've done that, and it's a terrible, terrible move. Good call, though, Dave. Thanks very much indeed. Dave says he'll never vote Tory again because they've completely messed up the mortgage rates, they've completely messed up the interest rates, they've completely messed up the economy.
Yeah, and they're completely messing up any chance of winning the next general election, a controlled demolition. Interesting take there, though, Martin, wasn't it? But he's talking about supply-side inflation. That's actually what the problem is, and they're not dealing with that. Also, do other countries do this? Yes, they do. Actually, almost all countries in the Eurozone have farmed out their policy to the European Central Bank, for example, haven't they?
That's right. And the Federal Reserve is supposedly independent of the government, but it's actually controlled by the private banks.
Are there any policies left the government do control? Well, the industrial policy's gone, isn't it?
Don't forget that one of the things that led to the quasi-Kwarteng crash and burn was that Liz Truss was hinting that she was going to take the Bank of England, get rid of the independence of the Bank of England. Now, I think there's a strong case for the Bank of England not to be independent, and because in the past, of course, the Bank of England just had to do what the Treasury told them to do.
But you've got to have the right Chancellor in that situation. Maybe somebody like John McDonnell rather than Jeremy Hunt.
All right, but I mean, I think it's really rather interesting that lifelong Tory voters like him are saying we don't want an independent central bank, because independent central banks were rammed down our throats by the Tories. Yeah, they were the ones
by,
who said,
not by necessarily by people like him. I mean, well, this is, and also, Brown, of course, by Gordon Brown.
Brown who made the decision.
This is lobbying, a very powerful lobby in the City of London that's been taking control of the Treasury and the Bank of England. It's now in full control.
Yeah,
of
the
both.
Argument in favour of independent central banks, and I'm not saying I accept it, I'm just playing devil's advocate. The argument in favour from independent central banks is that the markets know that the interest rates are not going to be manipulated to help win elections. So, for example, the monetary policy will be sound, like the Bundesbank's policy was supposedly sound. And if you do that, you can then borrow money more cheaply because there's a confidence element involved in this.
Well, how about manipulating rates so that people go bankrupt, businesses go bankrupt, and that the big finance people can buy all this stuff up for peanuts?
What they're doing is that the only way they know how to control inflation is by raising interest rates. What we really need is an incomes policy like they had in Scandinavia. So even in Britain in the 1970s, we had inflation peaked at 27% under Geoffrey Howe, Tories it peaked under, because he increased interest rates, which then increased mortgage rates, which then increased the inflation rate, which is exactly the feedback loop that you do get in Britain because of our obsession with home ownership. Other countries don't get that feedback loop. And that's why the British economy is uniquely exposed to financial crashes, which is why we should have built more council houses. We should have had unions that are powerful enough to raise wages in line with productivity and inflation, and we could have had a social democratic
country. But
all
of this really comes back to the financial policy. Whereabouts the money is going from? Who is in? Surely it makes sense to have a decent, honest a Chancellor of the Exchequer, obviously not Jeremy Hunt, where nothing is going on inside. Yeah. He's quite right about that. I mean, Hunt has just gone from one disaster to the next, and, you know, one does wonder if he's, you know, his real puppeteer is his Chinese wife. God knows, but nobody seems to be, there's really nothing going on in there. He's the worst person in the world to do that job. And somebody like John McDonnell Martin may be thinking, well, what we need is the people's QE. What we'll do is we'll create money using the Treasury, and we'll start spending it in order to get the economy moving.
Well, that is a perfectly legitimate way to look at it, but of course, even though that would be a sensible policy, John McDonnell as a Chancellor would face huge opposition from the city, from the Americans, and all the rest of it. So you can't just do what you want, even if you change the Chancellor. The fundamentals are worse than that. I mean, I've read an article recently by Simon Wren-Lewis. Now, he's in favour of central bank independence, but he says you've got it's got to be within a context where he used to be on the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, and he wouldn't have voted to raise interest rates in this position. In fact, two members of the committee did not vote for it. They said, no, we shouldn't, because the problem
is... Well, they'll be removed, won't they? And the city will put somebody... Yeah, they might well be. Martin, what's going on here is the city of... As I said, the city of London is in pretty much firm control of the Bank of England. Most of the people that are sitting around that policy committee are people nominated by them.
Yes, but there's always a spread. What they try and get is a spread of economists from left to right on that committee, which they are, and therefore they often don't agree.
We're not going to see anybody like you sitting on that committee.
Well, no,
are
well
we?
I mean, they might have people, but they had people like what's his name now? Simon Wren-Lewis.
What about Richard Murphy? He's a really good.
Richard Murphy. Yes, but there was. Also,
we're not seeing him on the Monetary Policy Committee, are we?
That's right. But even if you didn't raise interest rates at this moment, because it's possibly counterproductive, the fundamentals of the economy are ruined. They've been ruined by 40 years of privatisation of everything
that's
nailed
down.
And the Tory voter that's always voted Tory needs to take responsibility for the state of the British economy after 40 years of Thatcherism, which he no doubt approved of.
Well,
And of course, we've now run ourselves into a cul-de-sac.
One of the things that seems obvious to me is that we've got this kind of leadership culture of people who've been sort of tapped up to be leaders who actually have got no real knowledge or interest in what they're doing. Many of them have got this kind of imposter syndrome where if you start to really quiz them and cross-examine them on what they're up to, they hate that because they don't really have any depth of understanding. They just put in those jobs because they have a certain... I mean, we were talking recently about Norman Dodds in the United States, where he was talking about the Rockefeller Foundation, for example, creating a whole stable of economists and a whole stable of historians in order to put their point of view in the university. So this seems to me what we've got now is these kind of areas of expertise of these people who've been basically just tapped up because they've not got any real expertise, but they're just singing from the same hymn sheet, which is a private profit, privately owned hymn sheet.
Yes, and that is the reason why we're in the mess. So Tory voter who phoned in put your hand up and say, yes, it's my fault because
he supported this for years and years. He said, I'm never going to vote for them again. Well, I've been conned, basically, wasn't he?
That's good.
And he's not the only one either. So let's have a little look. Before we go to look at Starmer, we have the 75th anniversary of the National Health Service. Before we hear from someone commenting on that, Martin, what do you make of this enormous institution? Because it's touched the lives, obviously, of almost every single person in the country, and it made a massive difference after the Second World War.
Well, it touched the lives of most people in the country, but of course Rishi Sunak has never been treated in a National Health Hospital, nor have many Tory MPs. So they've got a rather... they don't really use the system, so that's why they're rather blasé about dismantling.
A little bit like the school system.
Indeed.
Yeah. But anyway, so what do you make of the future for the health service? It's looking pretty rocky, isn't it?
Well, if we carry on down, I mean, what's happened is the mess up of the economy. We're now getting the usual stuff. Well, we would like to fix it, but we haven't got any money because blah, 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 blah. Now, we really need to change the attitude on things like that. Richard Bergen was probably mentioned in that little, he's one of the few MPs that we just like decide what we want to do and do it. But of course, it will mean raising taxes on wealthy people. There is no way the Tories are promising their wealthy backers that even though the economy crashed in 2008 and now we're refusing to buy Russian oil and gas and are complicit in the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which was an act of grotesque terrorism if you think about it, that's why prices are rising. And we're going to have a wartime economy. And a wartime economy will probably lead to people like Rishi Sunak having virtually all of their wealth confiscated. The 30 billion that they lost in 1 week, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng, that'll have to be, that's it, 30 billion of British taxpayers' money down the drain. Somebody has to pay for that. It'll have to be the wealthy people, won't it? Because the poor people ain't got any.
With the NHS, one of the most important costs is the cost of PFI. This is something which was introduced by the Gordon Brown government, but it's been accelerated under the Tories since 2010 and the coalition government. And the Guardian has done a pretty good job, actually. They've got a little section which is just everything to do with private finance initiatives. And Michael Goodyear, last year, did an excellent article which says NHS hospital trusts are paying hundreds of millions in interest to private firms. Guardian analysis of the hospital trust accounts found 101 owe £50 billion in future unitary PFI payments. Now, the estimate of cost, Martin, is that the PFI way of building a hospital is costing four times more. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of billions of pounds here of the NHS budget. Four times more than if those hospital trusts were to raise that money to build the hospital, to borrow it on the open markets. These PFI deals are costing around about four times more.
Well, I mean, the reason why Brown brought PFI in the first place is because he wanted the headline rate of public expenditure to be within a specified target. The reason he wanted that is because the Tory press constantly bray on about how big the state is and we can't, it's too big and blah, 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 blah. So it's absolutely idiotic for the reasons you've just pointed out. And,
Just to add something else to that, sorry to interrupt you, but the figures reveal that four NHS trusts see more than half of their total PFI unitary payments going purely on interest. So this is just standing still. Yeah. Yeah. Half of their payments.
Yes, in other words, if we don't abolish PFI in the National Health Service, it's like having cancer. We need an operation to remove it. I think people will eventually get angry enough to do the necessary things in this country. But there's an awful lot of delusion. Look at the Labour Party's current position, which is, we want to improve things and we'll be better than the Tories. But because there's no money, we'll have to be very patient and we won't be able to do very much. And we've got to keep public expenditure down. I think that will be blown out of the water. Because we are moving into a full-blown international capitalist crisis and tinkering around the edges simply won't work. And in any case, you can't cut public expenditure in such a crisis because all that happens is the economy goes down faster. The only way to stop the economy going down is to increase public expenditure. And if you're worried about that increasing the deficit, then you've got to tax the wealthy more because that's what we used to do in the 1950s. And that's why everything worked. The wealthy had their... were basically fleeced. and that they didn't like it and they rebelled against it. It's what Kaletsky pointed out they would do in the 1950s. It's not that this doesn't work. That is actually the best kind of capitalism. So they're allowed to go ahead and make their money, and then we take it off and give it back to the poor people at the bottom, and the whole thing works. If you don't do that, it don't work, and that's the problem. It don't work.
So the other big cost of the National Health Service is administration. Now they've introduced outsourcing. The admin costs, the general admin costs of the National Health Service have gone up four times as a proportion of percentage of the money that's being spent. Well, so if you add these PFIs into the admin costs, what you've done is, through this whole kind of semi-privatisation and the privatisation of the building of the NHS hospitals, there's something over a quarter, somewhere between a quarter and a half of the money that used to go towards patient care and to wages is now going straight into the pockets of the banks.
Well, this is the reason why the admin costs have gone up is because of the internal market, so-called, within the National Health Service.
Well, I say not it the banks, used, the lobbyists
it
have
used
been
to be,
pushing
it used
for this
to
anyway.
Be a top-down state-managed concern, and you get enormous economies of scale in that. Yeah. Which make you can do lots
it's
of things
also
cheaper.
Really good for morale.
Yes, that's right. Everybody knows where they stand and what they're doing. The
everyone's
doctors get
in
on
it.
With
we
the
are
doctors.
Really are genuinely all in it together. Everyone's pulling in the same direction. And,
yeah, but what the ideology was, we're going to create. What you do is you create a halfway house with the internal market and the National Health Service, so you can move towards the Tories' wet dream for the NHS, which is that it will be called NHS, but it's actually Deloitte. And others that are running it. It's just using the NHS
logo. You can see those little logos, can't you, at the corner. When it says NHS Hospital, there's some little, PricewaterhouseCoopers logo in the corner.
Well, this has been an ongoing plan for years. I mean, you know, the documents have come out showing Tory strategists talking. They all know that everybody loves the National Health Service, so they don't dare to directly attack it. But by bringing in all of these changes, they make a crisis, which then says, oh, we're going to have to change it all now. We're going to have to go to an insurance system, like in America. And of course, in America, they spend 15%, something like that, of their GDP on healthcare, and millions of people get no healthcare for that.
Anyway,
they're
look,
not looked after at all.
Earlier today, I spoke to Esther Giles, who is or was anyway a finance administrator within the National Health Service in this part of the world, and asked her what she made of the state of the NHS 75 years on.
I'm Esther. I worked in the National Health Service for all of my career, starting as a regional finance trainee. Eventually, I was director of finance for specialised services for the South region.
There's been two massive changes in the health service. One is the use of PFIs, and the other is this whole idea of the kind of internal market outsourcing. How have they affected how much taxpayers' money actually goes into patient care, Esther?
Well, there are various estimates of the amount of money that's required to run the internal market, up to £20 billion per year, out of that £140 billion overall. But it does depend what you include. Clearly, the more transactions you have in a system, the more transactional interfaces, the more bureaucracy that you need in order to sustain it, from everything from procurement to paying invoices and negotiating contracts.
At the moment, we've got these record waiting lists. From someone who's actually pretty knowledgeable on the inside, this was all sorted out under Gordon Brown. It does seem as if this is part of a mission to make the NHS not work very well, so people are buying private health care. But the main question is, are there simple ways to fix this, to actually get these waiting lists down? Because clearly people have been paying into the health service through their taxes, etc., and they really need it, at certain points in their life, they really need it, and they're not getting it right now, many people.
Just to put you right on something, Tony, you say people are paying into the NHS, and what I would say is the government can spend whatever it wants on the NHS, whether or not people pay into some sort of hypothecated fund. The government's made choices to fund the NHS before, and it could make choices to fund it again. So as for putting the situation right with regard to waiting lists, yes, under the Gordon Brown Blair era, waiting lists did come down dramatically. The government more or less doubled the spend on the NHS, but it included independent sector treatment centres, which were private clinics, hospitals that did easy stuff, like things like tonsils, ENT, simple fractures, hip replacements and so on, but didn't do anything complicated, so increased the complexity, the average complexity of what was left with the NHS. So part of the problem, part of the solution was also, solution inverted commas, was also about private finance initiative. So there's a big boost to the private sector with all that extra money that went in. As we're putting it right, there isn't a short-term fix. The government and even the Labour Party are saying, oh, we can use the private sector to fix the NHS in the short term. But the private sector is taking resources from the NHS. The NHS trains all the doctors, all the nurses, all the ancillary staff, all of them, and any staff that work in the private sector are taken from the NHS. And put that together with the fact that the chief constraint in the NHS is staffing. We can't get enough staff in order to keep all the theatres open, keep all the wards staffed. And that's partly because they've gone to the private sector, partly because there's a big issue of pay. You can get more money by working on a checkout at Aldi than you can by being a nurse. So it's not a short-term fix. There needs to be completely retrenched, bringing the private work back into the NHS, repeat of 1948, and there needs to be a massive recruitment program, which, okay, Sunak's announced that, but his program is about de-skilling, and there needs to be work on retention. And the chief factor in retention is paying NHS staff a decent amount of money. So a decent pay award is going to be the most effective short-term fix.
Yeah, we're seeing more and more of these strikes. What's do you think, I mean, look, obviously the last Labour government did a pretty good job with the health service. What do you think next year's Starmer government might do?
Reeves has been adamant that she will not put more money in the NHS than can be justified in terms of taxpayers' money, which, as I said, is total nonsense. Austerity is total nonsense. We've been able to afford a fully funded NHS where everybody had everything they needed in the past. We're much more wealthy now. There's absolutely no reason why we can't afford it again. So I'm afraid I think that the next Labour administration will be very much more of the same. It will be about training up staff that are less skilled and therefore cheaper. It won't be about decent pay awards, and it'll be about utilising the private sector. It will be about bringing costs down by reducing skill mix and outsourcing services that are as cheap as can possibly be obtained.
Do you think there's any hope then? Because it does look as if it's on a slow and rather painful decline, Esther.
It is, unless people just stand up and say enough, because my understanding is from all the research that's been done that people in this country support the basic founding principles of the NHS, which is healthcare which is publicly provided, where there is no profit, which is free at the point of delivery, and you get the healthcare you need when you need it. And most people want that. And even if you believed the austerity myth, even if you believed, which I don't, that you can only put more money into the NHS if you raise taxes, it would be a far more efficient method to fund the NHS by raising taxes than people paying money into the private sector, where they have to pay shareholders, as well as paying for their care, and they're making things worse for the NHS. It would be much better simply to spend more money on the NHS, and I think that's what people would be prepared to do.
Finally, we've got two massive trusts in Bristol, the South Mead Trust and then the Central Bristol one with the PRI. What's the flavour in Bristol? Are there any kind of moves towards, trying to beef up the NHS, or is it simply that they're bringing in people from the private sector to start running the NHS these days? What's the flavour in Bristol?
Well, the flavour in Bristol is that both of the big trusts are really struggling financially. Every year they'll have a massive cost improvement programme. Now that we have integrated care systems, there'll be all sorts of shenanigans going on to limit care, to reduce care, and within the envelope that the integrated care system has. So it's an American American health system approach to things, which is you have a fixed budget and you get incentives to spending less money. So I'm afraid that's what those two hospital trusts are going to be doing, alas.
Okay, Esther Giles, thanks very much for joining us.
All right then, thank you, Tony.
Yes, the glorious Esther Giles there, giving us a lowdown on the inside story, Martin, on what's been going on with the marketisation and privatisation of the National Health Service. What I'll do is I'll put a link up to her report of that name, Marketisation and Privatisation of the NHS, which looking at the extent to which the NHS is basically drowning in these PFIs and this outsourcing, slowly but surely, they're finding it less and less money available to pay their staff and to pay for the facilities that they need. I noticed this week Britain is bottom of the developed world countries in the number of MRI scanners that there are per head of population, for example.
Yeah, and also in terms of hospital beds, which have just been completely stripped out. Well, this has been going on for a very long time, and it's a ratchet, isn't it? So what happens when you get a Labour government is we get stuck where we are, and things don't deteriorate as rapidly as otherwise.
Or else we get something horrible like PFI start.
Well,
being,
I mean, yeah, indeed. But, yeah, but the PFI was continued by the Tories, and it's basically a Tory idea. I mean, Brown shouldn't have done it. But this is the problem. The Labour Party is in hock to exactly the same forces as the Tory Party, and they feel that they cannot challenge them, and that, you know, attempts to do so, you know, are futile because you can't beat them, so you've got to join them. And there's no fight or passion there to defend, to roll back the marketisation of the health service.
One of the bizarre things is that the many doctors now, particularly senior doctors in the practice, are spending a lot of their time poring over budgets that they're now having to manage. So back in the day, of course, you'd have administrators, people like Esther, to make sure they had the money to get on and do what they wanted. Now it's down to the doctors.
Well, that's right. And of course, what it does, doctors were never on the NHS payroll. And one of the things Starmer was hinting at, or I bet you he won't do it, is to put doctors directly on the NHS payroll. So we're moving back towards a system before the NHS where doctors were private businessmen with a bit of doctoring on the side. You know, it's a business. But of course, you know, the NHS allowed them to be doctors and doctors, you know, when you've got somebody with four top A levels in science, you do not want them poring over spreadsheets. You want them looking at medical books. That's what they're for. They're not supposed to be business people, are they?
Well, it sounds like you're being a little bit cynical about Keir Starmer, Martin. Surely he's going to save the NHS.
Well, Esther doesn't think so. I'm with Esther on this. They are the least worst evil in the circumstances. Because if we have the kind of people that run the Tory party now in power after the next election, they will be able to just loot at will. And they will push everything in the wrong direction.
Why should anybody vote Labour when you've got someone like Rachel Reeves, their shadow chancellor, saying, well, we insist on not spending any more money on the National Health Service? I mean, surely that's why people might vote Labour.
Yes, but because she's already got herself into the position in her mind that she's the Chancellor of the Exchequer and she's worried about things like the currency, the markets and all this sort of thing.
Yeah, she was swanning around at Davos, wasn't she?
Well, indeed, that's right, and that's the whole point. The Labour Party wants to present itself to those people as a safe pair of hands. And that means, don't forget, their calculation is that if people want the Tories out and want to save the National Health Service, they ain't got an option under first past the post. They simply have to vote Labour.
I think their tactic is a pretty cynical one, which is, we are just not say anything, not commit ourselves, try and kind of keep in the shadows, and let the Tory party implode under Rishi Sunak, destroy itself, and then people will just vote for us because they're so fed up with the Tories.
Well, that is the strategy. You've summed it up, and it may well work.
It will. I think it will. I think he'll be Prime Minister.
What you end up then is you end up with
Starmer
a Labour government with no commitment to doing anything
Starmer
radical at all.
Starmer will be Prime Minister next year. That's my little
interesting
thing.
Question is, will he be Prime Minister? Will he have an overall Labour majority?
Well, that's another question.
And I think that is definitely a 50-50 question.
Even the SNP, which has been growing for years, is now looking like it's
They will still be
itself.
The biggest party at the next election in Scotland.
Well, we shall see, because they're making a real mess of it up there. Almost as, you know, well, it's almost a competition between the Tories and the
Scottish government.
The Tories
today,
and the SNP seem to be competing as to who can make as much of a mess of it.
The SNP have got their problems, I agree, but they're not going to disappear as the largest party in Scotland. They just ain't. Parties don't just disappear like that. One of the things they did today, and I heard that on the radio today, the Scottish government is talking about the decriminalisation of all personal possession of drugs, because that's what they would like to do. Now, that is a bold policy, and I think it's good that a major political party like that is coming out and saying
Starmer
something like that.
Will say anything like that?
No, Starmer will hate that, but that's the SNP saying to their constituencies, we're more radical than the Labour Party. The Labour Party are English. The Labour Party are basically up the backside of the Tories. You need to vote for the SNP.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to an interview with Oliver Eagleton. I don't know if you've come across him, Martin. He's a journalist that wrote a book called The Starmer Project, and he's spent a lot of time looking deeply into this guy, Keir Starmer, and where he came from. Who is Keir Starmer? And here he is, an excerpt here from an interview he done with Loki, with Oliver Eagleton, the author of The Starmer Project.
Keir Starmer was the Director of Public Prosecutions from 2008 to 2013. And all DPPs tend to work quite closely with, other arms of the British security state. So the Foreign Office and the intelligence services. But Starmer did this to a really unique and kind of unprecedented degree. So under his tenure, the international division of the Crown Prosecution Service, which deals with overseas issues, was really kind of massively expanded, while lots of their domestic infrastructure contracted under the austerity regime. So what this meant in practice was that, you know, resources were poured into not just sort of, trying to clamp down on crime at home, but as they saw it, sort of dealing with the sources of crime overseas before they reached Britain's borders. So as they would see it, sort of drugs offences, migration offences, and kind of counterterrorism were the three main planks of that. So in this capacity, Starmer is in close contact with the Specialist Operations Directorate and sometimes with MI5, working on sort of where to allocate resources so as to best kind of serve their interests in a way which brings the CPS much closer to the government, much closer to the executive, and means that, as a lot of Starmer's colleagues kind of complained at the time, their sort of operational independence was really diminished, and decisions about where to, what kind of legal work they were doing were being kind of made in a way that was joined up with the government rather than sort of autonomously. But of course, Britain is not an independent state when it comes to foreign policy. It is very much integrated into the sort of transatlantic security apparatus. So as part of doing this work on kind of counterterrorism in particular, Starmer develops a close relationship with the Obama administration, particularly the State Department and the Department of Justice. And he goes over to Washington and has a series of meetings with Eric Holder, head of the DOJ at the time, who is kind of most famous for developing the legal infrastructure that underpinned the Obama administration's drone program, and who also sort of really, relaxed their approach to civil liberties in order for them to prosecute certain terrorism cases. So according to people who attended these meetings, there's a real sort of mutual respect and admiration between Starmer and Holder. And there's a deal that Starmer makes with the DOJ to say that they won't sort of contradict their interests in the CPS's overseas work, and the two organizations will kind of, be working in tandem. I think it was even put to me by one person that, the CPS became a kind of proxy for the American state when it was working in sort of the Caribbean or the Middle East, in countries where there's understandably a real suspicion of American involvement, where a sort of more neutral organization like the CPS can sort of carry out their objectives without being seen to be sort of interfering in that way. So I think an important part of Starmer's political formation that he comes very close to these centers of power in both Britain and in the US. And I think there's a strong suggestion that the way he dealt with some of the CPS's cases over here was influenced by his proximity to figures like Holder. So I guess one of the most sort of famous instances of this is Julian Assange's case. As we all probably know, you know, for many of these years, Assange was holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy because he was wanted for questioning by Swedish prosecutors on accusations of sexual assault. And he was unwilling to travel to Sweden because he knew that from there he would be extradited to the US, who wanted him on espionage charges and who probably would have put him in a military prison for the rest of his life. So, you know, in cases like this, it's kind of standard practice that if for some reason, you know, someone is wanted by foreign authorities, but they can't go and travel to that country, those authorities will come to Britain to question them. This happens all the time with all kinds of cases. But when Swedish prosecutors suggested that they come over to Britain to question Assange, the CPS under Starmer sort of intervenes and really tries to prevent them from doing that and is very kind of cagey about the reasons for that. And then likewise, a couple of years later, when Swedish prosecutors have grown kind of tired of the case, it's consuming a lot of resources and they want to drop it, again, the CPS intervenes and says, no, you must keep this case going. The exact form of words that they use is, don't you dare get cold feet. So, you know, this is a very kind of unorthodox way of dealing with a case like this. And one can infer from some of the emails that have been leaked, even though they're quite heavily redacted, that these decisions were being made in the CPS at a very high level.
So that's Oliver Eagleton there, the author of the 2022 book, The Starmer Project, bringing up all sorts of interesting points about Starmer's track record. I mean, it just sounds to me, take a step back from the, you know, possibility of being sued, but Starmer just seems to be someone who's working for the Americans. I mean, he's just doing what they say, everything that they want.
Yes, I think he would regard that as a compliment, and that's the problem. The control of Britain by the US is virtually complete. And the you know, if we get David Lammy, for example, who's probably going to be the foreign secretary, you know, the MP for Tottenham, he's West Indian origin family, but he's absolutely on board with the US policy on Ukraine, for example, and other issues like Assange. So, I mean, there's not much, you know, you can't expect too much of these people. They are who they are. They are part of the establishment. We need to change the political system. We need to change the economic system. All sorts of things need to change. These people aren't those people to do that. They are the people who are part of the system, and they're probably going to be slightly better than the people running it now. But don't presume that they're going to be doing anything to change society for the better, because that's not what they're about.
Well, on Tuesday evening, and actually on yesterday evening too, on Channel 4, there was a tremendous program. I mean, this is why some people say, oh, I haven't got a television, I never watch. Look, you just because you're only watching it once every few months doesn't mean you say you shouldn't have one. And this was Ghislaine Maxwell, The Making of a Monster, the story of the rise and fall of the world's most enigmatic female sex trafficker. There's three episodes. It was a bit of a grueling three-hour session. First episode was called Queen Bee, a deep dive into Ghislaine's early life. Were there early signs of bad things to come? Episode two, Hidden in Plain Sight, Ghislaine and Jeffrey Epstein lived the high life, committing crimes behind closed doors. And episode three, The Reckoning, rumours of the sexual abuse of underage girls marked the beginning of the end for Ghislaine Maxwell. They focused on her, Martin, but I thought it was a brilliant programme. I don't know if you came across it, but what they did was a US journalist got hold of the Jeffrey Epstein list of various clients and friends and people that had been on his aeroplane and that kind of thing. And he just went, phoned them all up. Some of them obviously didn't answer. Some of them just put the phone down. But it was quite interesting that there were several of them who decided that they did want to go on camera and they would quite openly talk about their relationship with Jeffrey. And this man, it was quite clear that Ghislaine Maxwell played a very important role in creating a, I mean, he was the guy who many of the people went to the island and to his New York and London homes to see. But she was the one that made sure that there were plenty of young girls hanging around who were prepared to have sex with people.
She's been focused on because Epstein, of course, supposedly committed suicide in prison. And I bet you they didn't really cover the Mossad angle to all of this in this 3 hours, because that's the big elephant in the room. Well, this is not just random sex trafficking.
One of the things that
intelligence operations.
I mean, it was shocking stuff because there were various people who felt, you know, it was a brilliant documentary because there were various people who felt they really wanted to get stuff off their chest about her. So apparently one of them, a sort of older guy, I mean, I suppose he was in his 60s, he was approached by Ghislaine Maxwell and she said, well, if you let me have sex with you, I will tell you all about what happened to my father, that sort of thing.
Well, that's very interesting. But I mean, basically, Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein were working for Mossad, and Mossad are also integrated into Western intelligence services. This is all honey trappery. That's what it is. And of course, and everybody focuses on Prince Andrew, who's obviously
that was one of the curious things about the documentary.
Up,
yeah,
you know,
that was a curious thing about the documentary is nobody. I mean, they were talking about whole loads of scientists that were spending a week over on Jeffrey Epstein's island, for example. They didn't name a single one of them. The only one they were talking about was Andrew.
But I think what they were doing there is they were creating. They basically wanted everybody who has got any influence at all, including Stephen Hawking. You know, all of these people. They were all given. You know, and of course, if everybody else is doing it, you think, well, it can't be too bad because all these other people are doing it, so I might as well just join in. And of course, in actual fact, that means that Mossad has got, or whoever they were working for, has got all of this dirt on all of these people.
And London,
and you don't go and broadcast it around. You just keep it, don't you?
London,
and then speak to them privately and say, you don't want to do that, do you?
London and New York, famous rock stars like people like Mick Jagger would always be at the Ghislaine Maxwell parties. And so they were a great attraction for people,
That's why, so everybody thinks, well, if everybody else, you know, it's be there or be square. And everybody's in on it. And of course, the main point is that the young girls have to be young enough that they can be classified as underage in the US.
One quite interesting woman who was saying how Ghislaine was trying to procure her as a middle-aged attractive lady for Mick Jagger, for example. I mean, she realised, well, hang on a minute, the point here is to get me to come back to his place, and I'm just not going to do, you know. So obviously the younger girls, obviously, which are far more vulnerable, who were, and there were some amazing interviews there with young girls. I mean, we're talking about teenagers who were brought in to do massage and then suddenly found themselves trapped on an island they couldn't get off of.
Yeah, well, the whole point of using teenage girls is because it's potentially illegal and therefore you can blackmail people. You know, some middle-aged lady having sex with Mick Jagger is not blackmailable. But Mick Jagger having sex with somebody underage, that is.
Yeah, but it's doing a favour for Mick, which means he might come to the next party.
Yes, oh, yes. And of course, you're just generally creating a good vibe about all of this. You know, there's no fool like an old fool. All of these old guys presumably thought that they were so attractive, and that's why these 17-year-olds wanted to go to bed with them, you know.
Anyway, so that's definitely... I'll put a link up to that on our show page. The programme is called... Ghislaine Maxwell, The Making of a Monster, 3 hours, three parts on Channel 4 on Tuesday evening and on Thursday evening this week. Really well worth watching, amazing. I mean, I was pretty cynical to start with, and I am still a little bit cynical, Martin, because they didn't really go into into the Mossad angle.
Well, this is what's missing from most of this stuff.
But very, very interesting, nevertheless, as to actually hear people who are very close to them. And, of course, if you've got the Mossad angle in the back of your mind, you can see what's going on even more clearly. Yesterday, not only this programme on Channel 4, we had a meeting here in Bristol, which was with a group called Keep Bristol Moving. And the Together Declaration, really quite fantastic, packed out Rose Green Centre up in Whitehill. I went along there. I was surprised. This is okay. So the basic idea is the Bristol City Council is bringing in these what they call livable neighbourhoods, livable cities, 15-minute cities, and closing down roads. And there's a lot of people getting really rather annoyed about it. And we'll be hearing from Samira in a minute. But first of all, Sid Lawrence. Sid is a former Gloucester cricketer. He's also now the president of Gloucestershire Cricket Club. And he runs something called Dojo Nightclub on Park Row in his retirement, whereas he's now found for the last 2.5 years that he's actually not allowed to have any deliveries outside his nightclub because there is a inviolable bike lane right the way along Park Row outside his and many other businesses. So none of these businesses are allowed to have any vehicles actually park outside them, which means they can't have... And before we hear from Sid Martin, there's something kind of bonkers about this, isn't there? How can you run a pub or a nightclub if the brewer's lorries can't park outside and deliver beer and take away the old cakes? They're basically shutting you down, aren't they?
Well, it would appear so. Obviously, this is extremely controversial. What's going to happen politically in Bristol is that the Greens are probably going to end up running the council after the next election. And I suspect that they, in fact, probably agree with a lot of this stuff.
To close down Sid's nightclub?
Well,
it's not just him. Now, there is a hidden agenda here, mm-hmm. which Sid doesn't really touch on, which I look at. And I think, well, actually, maybe what they really want is the property developers to come in and take over his nightclub and turn it into housing.
Well, I do not know what the may well be that the design of this is completely wrong. They've put it through because Bristol has got all these kind of supposedly green credentials. If Ferguson was running things, I don't suppose things would be that different.
No, I think they would. Yeah, because the thing is, Ferguson was a listener. Well, everybody at this moment, there were hundreds of people at this meeting. Everyone was saying with the same voice, the council doesn't listen to anyone. It's got all these sort of forms. Yeah. You can contact them. It says, please write to us. Please come along to the consultations. But actually, they've got tin ears. They're not listening to anything.
Well, that's probably why they're going to lose the next election.
Yeah, may well be. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Sid Lawrence, former Gloucestershire cricketer, talking about what's happening to his Dojo nightclub on Park Row since they put a great big cycle lane all the way along that side of the road, stopping anybody parking, including delivery vans.
Within the last 3 years, suddenly the council, without any consultation to any of us, and it's not just me there, there's probably another 10 shops there, restaurants, hairdressers, cafes, and with no consultation to any of us, they put in a bike lane all the way through. So basically, we cannot now get any deliveries. My delivery guys who deliver, you can imagine, deliver big kegs of beer are refusing to deliver. So that's affecting my business and my livelihood. I've tried to speak to the council about it, about giving us some form of a period when I can, you know, we have 2-3 hours timescale where we can get our deliveries. Even that would be difficult. But nobody seems to want to engage in talking to us. So it's just made my life really, really difficult. And like I said, they don't seem to be wanting to be held accountable. And I think the word is accountable, the council, which I find very disappointing. But they're just making my life really difficult. And what's wrong, I feel injustice about it all, the cyclist, when we double park, because I need to get my out of my car, I have beer, I need to get out of the car, the cyclists then take photos of me, and I know what they're trying to say, because they think I'm double parked, but that's the only way I can get my deliveries into my premises. And you've got to remember, there's another probably, I would say, 40 flats above Park Row. So if they want a TV or a washing machine delivered, impossible. So they haven't really thought about it. They haven't sat down with anybody and spoke to any of the residents there to say what our views are. but it's affecting, you know, you've got cafes, restaurants there. You've got a hairdresser. His customers are probably 50, 60% over the age of 60. Now, they need dropping off. So it's like I said, the council are making our lives really impossible. And they're going to threaten people's livelihoods as well. That's what they're going to do. So they need to listen and they need to be held accountable. I think nowadays in life, everybody, you know, I'm involved with Gloucestershire. I'm their president. We deal with diversity and inclusion. And what I always say, everybody must be held accountable now for their actions. And that's all I've got to say. Okay, thank you.
So that's former Gloucestershire cricketer Sid Lawrence, who's spent his retirement savings on the Dojo nightclub in Park Row, Martin, which is slowly getting less and less customers. And he's having an almost impossible job to actually get beer delivered to his shop now because of this cycle lane. And of course, you know, what they've done is they've set the cyclists against the shop proprietors along there. So as a cyclist cycle along and they see some sort of vehicle either dropping somebody off or dropping some crates of beer off or something, they say, oh, right, you know, how can you have a cycle lane all the way along a road which is full of shops which need to be buying and selling things? If they can sell them, people can go, you know, walk up and buy them and take them away if they're not too heavy. But you can't have anything delivered to those shops anymore.
Well, I mean, that was a very reasoned argument that he made, wasn't it? And I think the problem is with all of these things is people think, oh, wouldn't it be great? We need cycle tracks. You know, that's the future. And then they impose them and then they haven't thought through the implications of what they're doing. But of course, there may be a lobby of cyclists who will, if you try to move that cycle lane, they'll be going, they'd be kicking off saying, oh, we're used to this cycle lane now.
Listen, do you know what? Most of those cyclists would totally understand if Sid is there flagging them down, having a chat with them saying, would you mind signing my petition so that I've got a few hours a night where I can deliver stuff to my door, would probably sign it,
well,
Martin. Yeah,
well, I think that you're possibly right there, Tony, but I think the thing is the current administration will probably be out after the next election. I think the Greens are going to form an administration in Bristol. They will then have to inherit all of this and decide what they want to do about it.
Maybe they'll listen. Who knows? But anyway, there's another aspect to all of this. In Barton Hill, there's this whole 15-minute city neighbourhood being planned in Barton Hill and slowly implemented. Samira Musa, she's one of the community activists around there. She had some fascinating things to say. She said, well, a couple of years ago, they came along and did a consultation. They said, what do we want? And we said, we want this and this and this and this. And they got none of it. What happened was this was just simply imposed on them.
Hi, everyone. My name is Samira Musa. I'm a director of Barton Hill Activity Club. I'm a resident in Barton Hill as well. I'm a mother of two who lives in a tower block. Most of our residents don't speak, their first language is not English, so this consultation wasn't included a lot onto the languages. And it wasn't clear from the beginning that it was in a road closure, the end of game. All they told us is, we want to improve the area. What do you want to improve the area? And what we asked was safer zebra crossing, lollipop lady for the local school, pharmacy, which we don't have, dentist, improvement to our green spaces, and none of that was considered. So next phase of the consultation, I was involved. Five people went to the second phase of the consultation and later stickers to where they want to close because we weren't included. So as a resident who lives in the area who takes her child to a school that is miles away because there's not any school in our area as well. We most dense populated in the whole, I think, Bristol. We live in a tower blocks and, you know, we don't have enough spaces. We have a green space, which we need improvement for, but it's not happening. Our green space is empty. And recently we've been told it's going to be given away to a cricket club who's from Gloucestershire or South Gloucester. So whatever we asked is not considered, but the council is just doing what they want to do. So I'm here on behalf of those children, those mothers, those families who's been ignored by the council. And, you know, we say no to road closures. Improvement we want, but not road closure.
So the one thing they didn't want was road closures, but the one thing they did get was road closures. No new pharmacies, no new schools, nothing else, just road closures, which they didn't want.
Well, if you think about the things that they wanted, where's the council going to get the money to provide those things? So road closures are easy, aren't they? They're cheap. And it can, and then they can tick a box saying, oh yes, we've reduced traffic problems in Barton Hill. I mean, all of these issues are to do with, you know, the council not listening. That's clearly coming through very clearly. But there are also fundamental conflicts in what local communities want. Some people want something and other people want something else. And they don't always agree.
Well,
there
isn't
necessarily
a consensus. They call them livable neighbourhoods. But the thing is that you can't actually... I mean, one of the points which was made again and again last night was this problem that ambulances have. I mean, they've had ambulances heading up the street and then realising they can't actually get around. They've got to reverse all the way back down, reverse out into the main road, go down and try another street because the ambulances don't seem to know where these massive planters that have been put in the middle of the roads to stop anyone driving down them are there. Obviously, that is extremely dangerous. Anyway, another person on the panel was Justina Kowalska, who runs something called the React Cats, which is against this clean air zone. And she had this to say about, in the opening of her speech, about the quite obvious, if you look into it, I mean, we did some of this at the time. The council's been told there are all sorts of ways you can reduce clean air, and you don't have to introduce a clean air charge, but the council has decided to do it anyway.
My name is Justine, and I run React Cats campaign against clear air zone charges in Bristol and Bath. Today I would like to focus mainly on clear air zone issues. I'm not sure if everyone heard about an organization called Client Earth. Well, that organization has won 3 court cases, and the outcome was that UK government had to produce stronger plans to improve air quality. One of the documents published in 2017 called Clear Air Zone Framework states, clear air zone proposals are not required to include a charging zone. Local authorities will need to consider the impact on local residents. They will also need to take action as necessary to support and protect the economy of their local high streets and town centres, whilst ensuring that their clear air zone proposals will not result in displacement of the most polluting vehicles away from town centres to surrounding areas. When we look at Bristol clear air zone, which started on the 28th of November 2022, that's exactly the opposite.
Yes, she's made, I think, an excellent point there, Justina Martin, that this organisation that's Client Earth, which has kicked all this off, is saying is don't make it difficult for businesses to trade, more difficult. That's silly. Don't make it more difficult for small traders to get around. And also, don't just displace the traffic to elsewhere. And and at the end there, she gets this nice little round of applause because she's saying, well, that's exactly what this is doing.
Well, I listened to this debate with interest because, you know, it's all very well having, laudable goals like cleaning the air, reducing traffic and all the rest of it.
Well, they've done that, haven't they, by shutting roads and things like that. They've done a very good job.
Well, yeah, but the point is that that's a sledgehammer to crack a nut, isn't it? It's like what Marvin is and the administration are doing is they're just rushing this stuff through without having thought it through. Well, they're not listening to local residents saying, hang on, this won't work.
Big point that came across last night was the fact that there seems to be these policies seem to have been cut and pasted into Bristol from elsewhere with no questions being allowed about them, which is a dictatorial approach.
Sometimes I think that Bristol City Council and our local authorities here in Bristol, they are just like those three monkeys. They don't see people. They don't see elderly people, they don't see people with disabilities, they just simply ignore their families, friends, their carers. They don't hear our voices. They don't hear tradespeople saying that they simply cannot afford to upgrade their vehicles. The offered grants are up to £2,000. When you're a plumber, electrician, builder, can you rely on public transport? The answer is no. Can you upgrade your van when someone is giving you £2,000? The answer is no. On top of that, the last monkey doesn't talk. This is how I feel about Bristol local authorities. All MPs, all councillors, and mayors have been invited to attend that meeting. My question is, where are they now?
So her reference to the three monkeys, did you get that, Martin?
Yeah.
This is the see no evil, hear no evil,
speak no evil.
But, I mean, she says at the end there, ironically, well, they're not speaking. So we've invited people from the city council, including the mayor, but they haven't turned up at the meeting. Well, why can't they just come along and explain what's going on?
I think because they are out of touch, let's put that in the most diplomatic way.
The mayor particularly seems to be much more comfortable speaking to the BBC, for example, doesn't he? A more cosy environment there.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, he's rather shy of meeting people who don't agree with him. I think what they've done is they've just, as you say, cut and pasted some, you know, ostensibly green measures, and then they demonise those who oppose them as people being NIMBYs opposing their green measures. Now, I haven't got a dog in this fight in the sense that I'm prepared to listen to everybody's arguments here. Let's just listen to what the arguments
are. One councillor did turn up, Councillor Steve Smith. He's a Tory, but he wouldn't say that in the meeting. So let's have a listen to what he had to say, Steve Smith, about the way they've been fighting these 15-minute city plans and the low transport neighbourhood plans in his ward in Westbury on Trim, and they've fought them successfully.
Yes, let's organise, let's campaign, let's try and change the policy at the big council level, at national level. But at the really local level, in each individual ward around Bristol, if local residents work with their councillors, and means having a councillor that's willing to work with you, you can make a difference. You can push back on this stuff. I've done it. I'm a councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henley, so I've crossed the other side of the city. I mean, yeah, so, fairly affluent sort of area, but it's an area that's got one of the oldest populations in the city, and we're out on the edge of the city, so a lot of people rely on their cars. We had a scheme put out a few years back now. The council did the usual thing. Engineers sat in a bunker for a couple of years. We knew something was going on. We knew there was a scheme coming. We asked them to come and talk to us. Nothing. Eventually, this scheme was published. They told us about it as councillors on Friday afternoon. They published it on Monday morning. That was it. And it came out then it was the usual sort of consultation. We've already done it. It's a finished design. Do you love it or do you like it? That was kind of the thing. So we organised with our residents, and working together with our residents, we organised meetings, we organised protests, we organised objections going in. We got thousands of objections in, mainly by just raising awareness. People didn't know this was happening. We raised the awareness, we got the objections in, and by working together, it wasn't just the three of us councillors, but by working together with all of the residents in the area, 95% of that scheme was chucked out. And it can be done. It can be done.
And now they're going to build on it, all these houses. How can we trust councillors? How can we actually trust local politicians? The government is corrupt as you like. And we're being taught about shopping centres not being...
So there's a little bit of an intervention there. I mean, it seems that this has become an issue for the Conservative Party in Bristol. They're concerned about, particularly about small businesses suffering as a result of these road closures, the clean air charges, which makes it really, really difficult for them to just go about and do their job every day. They're being basically charged a toll to do it. And they don't have to be, as we heard from Justina earlier. So the Tories seem to have picked up the baton, but nobody else, even though it's actually affecting, mostly affecting poorer people.
Well, I mean, it's, the thing is, the party politicisation of this then leads the other side to dig their heels in saying, well, it's people in Tory wards who are complaining.
He wasn't
blah,
making
blah,
a big
blah.
Thing about that. He said, no, look, no, I don't I, see I, this I as a party political thing. Said. He's just talking about the way it's affecting people in his ward. He's not making party political points, is he?
No, but at the same time, the party politics of this in London, for example, are pretty clear. It's the outer London boroughs who are objecting to the ULEZ scheme and so on. And so the political, this then, I mean, in a way, that's what politics is for. You know, people take different sides on these kind of issues, and then that helps to define the political environment in which people are operating, and people choose their sides and all the rest of it.
But there were some very good contributions from the audience as well, actually. It was fascinating, because this hasn't really been done in Bristol. It's been done in other cities where everyone gets together to do this. So very well done to Keep Bristol Moving and the Together Declaration for getting it together. And one of the ladies was saying, well, she actually went along to one of these consultations, one of the members of the audience, and started actually quizzing the council officers about what exactly had been going on. She got some very interesting answers.
Yeah, hello. I found myself to be right in the middle of the trial area, so I'm taking this a little bit personally. I'm a delivery driver, and of course we work out our routes by being as efficient as possible to minimise time to get around the area. It's quite obvious that now that they're going to try and block off neighbourhoods and we can only access them from the main road, we're going to be wiggling around the city and taking a lot longer. So it cannot be possible that these systems, these trials, are going to reduce emissions. That just doesn't make sense. I did go to a drop-in session. I managed to speak to a young man from the council who said he was the project manager for this. I tried to push him on a few points, particularly saying, where does this come from? It's not coming from the people. This is not democratic. Where does it come from? He did try to not answer. Eventually, he sort of said something about, we've been planning this for a long time. I don't know who the we is. And eventually saying something about Labour, the Labour Council. A couple of points he said, or I picked up at that session, that I find absolutely amazing. Maybe somebody can confirm. He said the council is planning to increase the population of Bristol by 500,000 people in the next 10 years. So I said, well, that's your problem. How are we going to reduce emissions if we're going to double the population? That's the problem. If that's your plan, then you're the problem. But, you know, nothing else. All these schemes will not reduce emissions, whatever we do. So if that's true, that's terrible. He also said that they're trialing them, then they'll consult on the trials, and they want them permanent by 20 or in 2027, which I understood to mean across the whole city. It could have just been our neighbourhood, but I understood that across the city. So that's a couple of figures that I thought were interesting. In terms of the whole process, which I'm just amazed that the councillors were not involved. I mean, what are the councillors for if they're not involved? I don't understand that. So, as what I now see is a prelude to this sinister scheme, just if I may give an example on my street, I'm just off Church Road. I used to be able to go to the end and turn right or left. And that road at the end connected all the side streets. It was very convenient. You just go in the direction that you want. They've now blocked off, a couple of years ago, a short section of only 150 metres in front of the school, saying it was about the school and it was about making that area safer and quieter. And they consulted on this plan. And on the first day the consultation came out, I responded. And I saw that the consultation was a complete fraud. They didn't ask if the changes, this blocking of one section of the road, which now meant that I cannot turn left, no one can turn left, we'll have to go the other way, whatever direction we're going, we have to go all the other way and round. They only asked about the impacts on that little section. So the questions were, will that little section of road be quieter? Well, of course. Will it be safer? Of course. Less pollution? Of course. They didn't ask or care about the whole area, so they didn't care what the impacts were as a whole. So it was a setup, it was a fraud, and I feel quite upset about that. It is not proper. It's not proper. It's so I feel it's bullying.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose her main point there is, Martin, that this is something which is a policy which has been drawn up behind closed doors, really, and actually the public consultation is just a tick box exercise.
Well, it sounds so, doesn't it? I'm listening with interest to all of this, because I think what the council seems to be doing is they're just tick boxing on things that they think are going to improve the environment without thinking through the implications. We are dependent on cars in Bristol because the public transport is so
rubbish.
Just
Bristol, matey, is it?
Well, it's not, but no. Bristol's particularly dependent on it. So you could.
Because our public transport is particularly appalling.
Well, that's the answer to all of this is to get proper public transport, and then it automatically reduces car use.
You've just hit on the next contribution, because one of the ladies stood up and said, look, you know, if you haven't got decent public transport, you simply can't do this. You can't get rid of cars and say that cars are no good anymore.
Yeah, you're going to have to get rid of them. What you want is people having cars but not using them as much. So if they do need to take an elderly relative somewhere, they can. But if they're just popping down to the shops, as you go on a free bus,
I mean,
why not?
In any sensible city, maybe you just get rid of your car and then you use either a cab or you use forms of public transport to get around.
If you've got public transport, the streets become quieter, and therefore people who do need to use cars for whatever reason can use them. Because some things, cars or trucks are the only things you can't cart heavy stuff around like barrels of beer.
These are the sorts of points made by this lady.
Solutions. I sit here and I've almost forgotten the glaring solution, because in this country we've forgotten the obvious solution to extreme mobility on cars and the problems that they can cause, and it's public transport. Over the past few decades, we've had our railways run down. They've become expensive and unreliable. I had to give up using GWR because I just couldn't get to work using them. Bus services are run down, and they've been cut in Bristol and in London recently, and nobody talks about it. And if you do mention it, you're often told it's too expensive, it's too complicated. We are an advanced society. We're supposed to be one of the richest countries in the world, and we have created a society which depends on mobility. So if we want to think about solutions, and if we want to get our politicians thinking about solutions, we need to get public transport back onto the agenda.
And the next contribution, next lady contribution came to talk about the disabled too.
Hi there. I'd like to address the issue of disabled people. How are we supposed to get around? I mean, I saw a disabled man being interviewed on Newsnight a couple of nights ago from London, where this scheme had started. It costs him £7 a day to get out of his area so he can go to the hospital, meetings, or whatever. £7 a day just to get out of his area. Is this what's going to happen to us? Because so far, money's not been mentioned, but they kind of put that thing onto you at the very last moment, just like this scheme.
One of the final clips we'll have a listen to is one of the contributions was about the bigger picture. I thought was a fascinating way. He was saying, look, we need to see what is actually going on here. It's like they say on the X-Files, the truth is out there, folks.
Hi there. I used to live in Bristol. I commuted for about 15 years by bike and by bus and on foot and by car. I agree with the last lady about public transport. I don't know if First still only do a policy of no return ticket before 9 o'clock in the morning. It made it impossible for me to do several jobs in the town centre. It just wasn't economically viable, so I'd agree with her on that. What the solution to that is, I don't know. But one of the solutions I haven't heard, really, apart from the chap at the top table, mentioned Davos. I think one of the things that people really need to do to get ahead of all of these problems is understand the bigger picture of what's going on. Where nobody yet has mentioned UN 2030. And there's also the Great Reset, which a lot of people say, oh, that's just a conspiracy theory. Of course it's not. And a lot of people, members of the public, don't know about these things. It's not on the BBC. They don't talk about it. There's very little in the way of public knowledge. I'm guessing from the response, a lot of people here do know about those things. But I think what we need to do is focus on the big picture and see how those top-level agendas are filtering down through and how our councils are not democratic. As you say, take back democracy. I also used to work for Bristol City Council for a couple of years as well. And I've seen that, how top-level agendas filter down through and lesser agendas are just immediately swept aside. There's a sort of hierarchy in terms of interests. And very often those interests are corporate. They're not. It's got nothing to do with the service they're bringing. It's to do with profit. And, I mean, that's kind of my point, really.
There was because the Together Declaration, there's a guy called Alan Miller was there to talk from there. I mean, he does this sort of thing all around the country. They're quite well organised. They've got quite a nice sound system. They stream their stuff live streamed. So if you go onto their Twitter feed, you'll pick up anyway whereabouts they're going next, and you can watch these live around the country. It seems to be one of the only places, although ITV West were down there, I'm not sure if they had a report on today, where you'll see these discussions actually taking place, because the council are sitting pretty. They've got their arms folded, Martin, aren't they? And they say, well, we're just going to do it anyway. We don't care what people think.
Well, I think that, you know, that's the picture that's appearing from the clips that you've, you know, all of those people, I think, can I say, talking very reasonably. You know, that's clear that they're not being, you know, the kind of things they're saying are worth discussing, and the presentation of what they're saying is in a reasoned fashion.
So before we hear from Alan Miller from the Together Declaration, I did actually chat to a lady just before the meeting started about why she was there, and she was absolutely adamant about her problem is that she cannot no longer get in to the city centre because her car falls foul of the charge if and when she ever does, even though she's disabled. She now feels that she's got to stay at home.
I'm concerned, and I'm skint as it is. I don't want to be skinter. I can't afford it. I wouldn't be able to afford it. I'm disabled, and I got a badge, but that's not going to protect me, is it?
No, what the council will say is they will pay you £1,500, if you're lucky, maybe, to actually help replace your car.
I don't want to replace my car. I got a little city car. I'm happy with my car. And I haven't got the funds to necessitate doing that, regardless of whether I get a loan, a grant, or whatever.
How have you found it so far with the Clean Air Zone?
I haven't really been out, if I'm honest. And I just avoid the towns. And especially around here, I'm not very familiar around here, but it's some old ground for my family. And I'm like, oh, God, can I go that way? Oh, can I go this way? I think it puts, for older people, particularly like me, who don't visit this area very often, it just puts you in a stressful situation from the beginning. Well, this bus gate thing is the biggest mugger on earth, particularly like the Bristol Bridge one in town. I know hundreds of people that have got stumbled on that because, and it's the same thing, they just want our money. And I'm in Bath, so I'm just supporting anybody that's going to stand up and be counted, really.
I think her main point, really, Martin, is that for people there, she's talking about the bus gate where the roads are all open, you can drive down them. It's just there's little cameras saying, we're going to charge this person. And if they don't notice that they've been through some zone, the signs aren't that big, actually. They'll get a fine of whatever it is, £80, £100, a few days later come through in the post. And so there's this kind of fear factor for particularly elderly people that they're afraid to drive anywhere near Bristol City Centre now.
Yeah, well, I hear all of this. I think the council, if they were wise, would actually listen to these people and make some kind of statements about why they think what they're doing is the right thing to do. But I think that the idea that this is simply, you know, it's been gestated by officers, presumably. But although I imagine that the political credibility of the administration has also been committed to these schemes.
From City Hall. I mean, this is what's happening. It's all kind of top-down stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, let's leave the final word to Together Declarations, Alan Miller, who made his attempt anyway to kind of sum up around about the middle of the meeting, just before it went out to questions from the floor. He had this to say.
It's so exciting to be in a room and on a panel. This is who we are. This is Britain. When they want to say that we're complaining about things, or we're saying you're imposing these things on us and you're not talking to us, and they want to call us names, and they want to not talk about the content of the issues, and they want to use smears, I would invite whoever does that, whether it's in the press or others that are being crass, to talk to the people, to listen to the opinions of the local residents and businesses and upstanding members of the community, and us, we the people. I think that the people that are running things have become contemptuous of the public. They've become managerial technocrats. They think we're all mad, bad and dangerous and stupid and out of control. And we're here tonight and around the country to say we're not going to have that anymore.
So that's Alan Miller from the Together Declaration. Of course, with all these impositions of the closing down the roads, trying to stop people using cars, having cars, owning cars, charging them to come into the centre, the obvious thing to be doing is to make public transport better. We hear news, thanks Dave for flagging it up, that on Wednesday this week, First Bus, who run all the private buses around here, they are announcing price rises to Bristol routes. Bus fares to increase, all day tickets and all trip passes are to see price rises. So this is, it's basically a slap in the face for anyone that's thinking, actually, why are the buses so expensive? Well, as of tomorrow, they're going to be even more expensive.
Well, this comes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning of the show. We should not have privatised the bus system in the 1980s. It was an idiotic thing to do. And, of course, it leads to the situation we've ended up in. And, of course, a lot of people who are opposed to what's happening now, they voted in the governments which privatised the bus services. And they therefore are responsible, since they voted for it, for that happening.
I don't think that's true at all, actually. I don't think Thatcher said that when she was standing for election that she was going to privatise water.
She did.
That she was going to privatise everything. No, she didn't.
She got re-elected on a minority of the vote several times by promising exactly that. And plenty of core Conservative voters have
1984, she did it. No, 1984 was the Falklands. She got re-elected on the Falklands.
No, but they had a manifesto with stuff in it as well.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about the Falklands, was it? And of course, we could come back to.
Let's be really clear here. Governments and local authorities here in Bristol, they get elected on a ticket, and then once they're in, they decide what they want to do.
Also,
there's no real attempt to hold their feet to the fire on the manifestos, is there?
Well, no, not really. And in actual fact, it's a very problematic setup.
They make promises and then they break them.
Well, or apart from the promises they make to the private bus operators, like Stagecoach.
True. Yeah.
They keep those promises. I mean, during the pandemic, the buses all had to be subsidised by the government, otherwise all of these bus companies would have gone bust. We used to have a Bristol bus company run by the council, and of course in advanced progressive cities around the world, they have got free public transport. In Tallinn in Estonia, in Seattle in the United States. Now that creates a completely different environment. You don't have to ban cars in that situation.
Okay, well, Martin,
people can still use cars, but the public transport is free, so most people are going to use that rather than
big pat on the back for the Together Declaration, Alan Miller and the people that helped organise that, and particularly Chris from Keep Bristol Moving. Really, really one of the best public meetings I've ever been to, with tremendously intelligent contributions, of course, the city leadership, so-called leadership, did not put in an appearance at all. Just before the break, Martin, fuel rip-off. Four big four supermarkets have ripped off drivers by about £1 billion with fixing fuel prices. So this is the Competition and Markets Authority so that's Tuesday this week, saying, they're just ripping everybody off. Now, they don't seem to have much teeth, these Competition and Markets Authority.
No, and of course, if you're a true free marketeer, you don't need to regulate the market. The market just is. So you can't question what people get charged by a private business. You could say, well, they're profiteering, but if it's a private business and they're making a profit, what business is
the government to intervene at all? Supermarkets have been increasing their margins roughly three times. So if they were making, say, 4 or 5 pence a litre on fuel, they're now making, whatever, 16, maybe even up to 20 pence a litre on fuel. So they're all doing it in concert together, aren't they? They're not actually competing at all.
It's an oligopoly, which is how real markets function.
And funnily enough, their prices are coming roughly down to the same price as the supermarkets as the ordinary petrol company, the places which are just petrol stations,
That's how the market's supposed to work. So if you can profiteer like that, then somebody else will lower their price and they will get the custom and so on and so forth. I think you do need to regulate markets. Of course you do. And you might have to bring in things like price controls. I think we're going to move to a more dirigiste economy because we'll have to. Ultimately, if we're going to go to war with Russia and all the things that that implies, we're going to have to ration petrol. Not a question, not on price. You'll just get a little ration book like in the war.
In the Sun article I'm looking at here, we've got the same things going on with the banks. Britain's biggest banks have been accused of blatant profiteering for not passing on higher interest rates to savers. What is the point of having a government if they won't regulate these supermarket petrol prices and they won't regulate the banks? The banks are just profiteering just as the supermarkets are.
Well, yeah, the answer to that.
And the oil companies.
Well, the answer to that is to look who funds the Conservative Party and who funds the Labour Party now as well. It's the supermarkets, the banks, and what was the third one you mentioned? Property developers. The wealthy corporate sector funds the political process. And the political process isn't free and fair because people who get less votes, like the Tories at the last election, win. And therefore, it's very manipulable by those people. Tory voters don't like being charged more for their when they go to the supermarket. But the Tory funders are the supermarkets.
The third one I mentioned was BP and Shell. You know,
BP and Shell, yes, the oil companies. Yeah, in Norway, they've got Statoil, which belongs to the national government. And as it makes profits, excess profits, that money all goes into the government and can be redistributed.
Nationalised, and particularly water. It's quite obvious what would happen to Thames Water last week. All these things need to be back in national ownership. But Keir Starmer was down at Davos promising the financiers of the world, including Klaus Schwab and his chums, that he was promising, I will never, ever, ever do
that's right. And that's because he's not Jeremy Corbyn. And Jeremy Corbyn didn't say that at all, did he?
Which is why the Labour Party destroyed Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, indeed, but that's because the system is rigged in favour of the corporate sector. We are an oligarchy pretending to be a democracy.
Run from the light, Satan's gonna see you. Run from the light, Satan's gonna see you. Run from the light, Satan's gonna see you all on that day. Well, don't make a sound, the devil's gonna hear you. Don't make a sound, the devil's gonna hear you. Don't make a sound, the devil's gonna hear you all on that day. Old sinner man, where you gonna run to? Old sinner man, where you gonna run to? Old sinner man, where you gonna run to? All on that day. Run to the Lord, Lord, won't you hide me? Run to the Lord, Lord, won't you hide me? Run to the Lord, Lord, won't you hide me? All on that day. The Lord said, sinner man, you should have been a praying. Lord said, sinner man, you should have been a praying. Lord said, sinner man, you should have been a praying. All on that day. Old sinner man, where you gonna run to? Old sinner man, where you gonna run to? Old sinner man, where you gonna run to? All on that day. The devil said, sinner man, step right in. The devil said, sinner man, step right in. The devil said, sinner man, step right in. All on that day. When you're digging the brown, the devil won't catch you. Digging the brown, the devil won't catch you. Digging the brown, the devil won't catch you. All on that day. Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run? Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run? Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run? All on that day. Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to? Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to? Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to? All on that day.
that day.
Let us pray. As we give thanks for the life of William Byrd, let us pray for all who in our own day make music to God's glory, whose creativity lifts our hearts to heaven. O God, who gave to human beings the gift to make music and the desire to turn this skill to the service of your praise, we thank you for all who create beauty through music, for their dedication and ability in their craft, and for the inspiration they bring to us. Grant that through your Holy Spirit and by the glory of their song, we may glimpse something of your perfect beauty and aspire to harmony and goodness in our own lives. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. On its 75th anniversary, let us give thanks to God for the National Health Service and pray for all who work in it and those they serve. And let us pray too for those who are charged with making and implementing policy for its future, that the God of healing may enlarge their vision and guide their decision making. God of healing, you bind up our wounds and revive us. And when we are in pain, you hold us in your loving arms. We thank you for the commitment, skill, and compassion of those who have served the National Health Service over the past 75 years. And we pray that through your gift of wisdom, it may be prepared to face the future with confidence, purpose, and hope. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. Amen. We pray as at evensong every day for David, our bishop, for Stephen, our bishop-elect, for Nicholas, Bishop of Grantham, and for our Diocese of Lincoln, particularly today for the Winterton group of parishes. We pray too for the members of this Cathedral Foundation of the Blessed Virgin Mary of Lincoln, both living and departed. Among those who died on this day in years past, we pray for Robert Wintringham, prebendary of Liddington and provost of Cotterstock, who died in 1420, and Thomas Penrose, prebendary of Bedford Minor and fellow of Exeter College, Oxford, who died in 1862. We pray also for William Byrd, organist and master of the choristers at this cathedral and gentleman of the Chapel Royal, the 400th anniversary of whose death was yesterday. And so we use the prayer laid down by St. Hugh for the daily use of the canons of this cathedral church. Almighty and eternal God, you are Lord both of the living and the dead, and have pity on all those whom you know will be yours in faith and works. We humbly beseech you that those for whom we have determined to offer our prayers, whether the present age yet holds them in the flesh, or the age to come has already received them out of the body, may of your merciful goodness come to pardon of all their sins, and so be held worthy of eternal joys. Through our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit, God for ever and ever. Amen. We join all our prayers together in the words of the grace. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit, be with us all, evermore. Amen.
Well, that's the tail end there of Supper's Ready, which is written by Peter Gabriel. Sung there by Phil Collins in Paris in 1977 from Genesis. And in the middle you heard a little excerpt from the, well, I thought was wonderful, little prayer for the National Health Service and, well, amongst other things, including one of their local musicians from Lincoln Cathedral. And Choral Evensong, which used to be on a Tuesday and a Thursday. Now I think it's only on a Wednesday on Radio 3. So obviously subject to the devil's cutbacks at the BBC. And before all that, you heard, that was The Seekers with Cinnamon from 1965. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with our Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And me, Tony Gosling. Now, we're going to start really by going back to the subject we were covering briefly there, looking at Keir Starmer's role in the jailing of Julian Assange by having a chat with the replacement for Assange as the editor of WikiLeaks. But before that, most important event of the week, really, without much shadow of a doubt, which is this raid, the Israeli Defence Force, calling it a defence force, attacking Jenin. What do you make of it?
Well, it's ongoing, isn't it? Because of the change of government in Israel, a much more belligerent attitude is being evinced. They are determined. I mean, they were cheering, apparently, when 3,000 people had to flee for their lives from Jenin. And I think Smotrich...
Who was cheering?
People in the right wing in Israel, the government, because they want these people to go. They basically said, you know, we're going to make life so miserable for you, you will have to leave, and we want this land. And they're openly saying that that's what they want to do. At the same time, we've got Michael Gove pushing through the British Parliament a bill which will prevent any public bodies in Britain, universities, etc., from disinvesting in Israel because it, apparently it's anti-Semitic. And this is the same week that all of these people have been killed by the Israeli Defense Forces. Now, of course, maybe if we're not going to be able to have boycotts and sanctions on Israel, there is only one final solution. Haha, maybe I shouldn't say that. It's war. Ultimately, the Israelis simply have to be defeated in war because sanctions ain't going to do it, is it?
I think it was Johnny Vedmore I was talking to earlier this week. He was interviewing me about what happened with the Sixth Fleet, Martin, because that was extraordinary, wasn't it? After the JFK assassination, Lyndon Johnson was president in the United States. The Six-Day War took place, and the Sixth Fleet, which is the U.S. Navy's fleet in the Mediterranean, one of its ships, the USS Liberty, was attacked by the Israelis. Jim Morrison, the Doors singer's father, happened to be the admiral of the Sixth Fleet at the time, and he ordered a strike on the Israeli air bases. And then he got a message from Lyndon Johnson, no, bring the planes back, we're not going to hit back at the Israelis, didn't he?
They did, and of course the whole thing was subsequently covered up. There's a really good documentary about it, I think it was on BBC Two, called, about the USS Liberty. Anybody can do the research, and you'll see that it was a deliberate attack by the Israelis. What they were hoping to do was that the Israelis would, the Americans would interpret this as an Egyptian attack, and that they would then attack Egypt. In other words, they were being manipulated by the Israelis. The US military are well aware of what went on there, but they're never going to go against what the US...
It was a sort of, that moment was almost a turning point, wasn't it? Because up until then, there had been a equivocal attitude towards Israel, not 100% from the US establishment. But from that moment onwards, it seems that the United States was, after that, 100% behind Israel.
Yes, well, if you think back to the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, there was a lot of soul-searching, particularly in the British government. Ernie Bevin, who was a Bristolian and was the Foreign Secretary, was very much opposed to the recognition of the State of Israel. So this is going to cause all kinds of trouble, because it's an unprecedented thing to say that people who've never lived somewhere can take a place over where people are already living and say they can have it. It's bound to cause trouble.
Anyway,
and it has caused trouble, hasn't it?
This week, on the BBC, Ajana Gajil, she is on BBC World, newsreader and interviewer, did, I thought, excellent, one of the best I've ever seen, interviews from the BBC of a former Israeli Prime Minister, that is to say Naftali Bennett, standing in for Benjamin Netanyahu, where she really does put some, I think, quite important points to him, and he comes back fighting about this attack this week by the Israeli Defence Force on the refugee camp in the West Bank in Jenin.
Well, we're joined now by the former Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, from Jerusalem. Good evening and thank you for joining us.
Good to be here, I'm joining.
First of all, the Israeli military are calling this a military operation, but we now know that young people are being killed, four of them under 18. Is that really what the military set out to do, to kill people between the ages of 16 and 18?
Quite the contrary. Actually, all 11 people dead there are militants. The fact that there's young terrorists that decide to hold arms is their responsibility. Look, at the end of the day, over the past year or so, we've had over 50 Israelis murdered, in many cases by terrorists that were sent from Jenin camp, armed, trained, and sent to kill and murder Israelis in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and across Israel. And Jenin has become an epicenter of terror. So we, unfortunately, had to enter this hornet's nest of terror and neutralize the terror. Otherwise, they're going to continue killing us. So, in fact, all the Palestinians that were killed are terrorists in this case.
Terrorists, but children. The Israeli forces are happy to kill children.
You know, it's quite remarkable that you'd say that, because they're killing us. Now, if there's a 17-year-old Palestinian that's shooting at your family, Anjana, what is he?
Under your definition, you are calling them terrorists. The UN are calling them terrorists.
I'm actually asking you, what would you call a 17-year-old person with a rifle shooting at your family and murdering your own family? How would you define that person?
We're not talking about that. The UN
That's
has
exactly
defined
what
them
we're
as
about.
Children. The UN has defined them as children, and we know that four people between the ages of 16 and 18 have been killed in this targeted attack. Let's not forget it's a targeted attack. The Israeli forces
yes,
are going
but
and looking
these are
for
terrorists.
These people.
I'm missing something. You know, a 17-year-old terrorist can murder civilians. We've had, there's a fundamental difference between what they're doing, which is explicitly and deliberately targeting civilians, and what we're doing, which is targeting terrorists. That's exactly the opposite. We're doing the right thing. They're killing civilians. And the fact that you're creating this moral equivalent, or even worse, I think it's unacceptable.
But isn't it language exactly like this, and actions exactly like the ones that are being taken, that are going to stoke tensions even more? If we're looking for a peaceful solution at any point, surely this, what you're doing in Jenin, and then the retaliatory attacks that we're seeing in Tel Aviv, are not the way forward.
Well, you know, if there were a town of terror, let's say 50 kilometers from London, and on a daily basis from that town, from that center of terror, there'd be civilians, UK civilians, being killed and murdered on the streets of London, I'm sure you'd send forces there. You know, we don't have much of a choice. In fact, the reason that we're seeing this rise in terror in Jenin is because Israel is not in Jenin. We left Jenin about 30 years ago in the early 90s. Israeli soldiers don't run around Jenin. And I guess when we let go of a certain territory, it ultimately becomes a hornet's nest of terror.
Well, this is, it's a dialogue of the deaf, isn't it, there? The fact is that they shouldn't be in occupation of large parts of modern Israel. They were given a state in 1948, and it was agreed to recognise the state of Israel, but it was been a very, very small and tightly defined boundary. They have never accepted that boundary. All the people in Jenin have actually been driven out of other parts of what is now Israel, and there's nowhere for them to go. You know, they say, well, they can go somewhere. Where are they going to go? They could go to Syria and live in a refugee camp. They could go to Lebanon and live in a refugee camp.
Well, he's saying they're all terrorists. This is a hornet's nest. This is the epicenter in Jenin. And those people are all terrorists, even the young people who've been killed. They haven't killed anyone who's not a terrorist, apparently.
Well, you could argue the same thing about the Irgun and the Haganah back in the 1940s. They were based inside the Jewish community in settlements that had been set up.
And he said they haven't got much of a choice.
The British didn't have much of a choice. They had to go in and kill the Israelis, because they were the ones who were the terrorists back in those days. Now, in actual fact, nothing the Palestinians are doing is any different from what the Israelis did when they were establishing the state. And if they can do it, other people can do it. Now, let's come back to the fundamentals here. We're talking about whether we're going to... One possible peaceful solution to this is for Israel to be isolated from the international community in the same way as South Africa was. And, of course, that is the position of the current South African government. They are in favour of sanctions on Israel. The British government is not. Now, if you say, well, we're not going to have sanctions on Israel when they're actually stealing somebody else's country, because that's what they're doing, and, people have got a right to resist that in international law. What was it Churchill said? We will fight them on the beaches. We will fight them on the streets of our cities. We will fight them in the mountains. We will never surrender. Well, that's exactly how the Palestinians feel about this. And there's only one solution, which is for the Israelis to withdraw from territory that they have stolen, just as the Serbs had to withdraw from Kosovo, and they're demanding that the Russians withdraw from Ukraine. Now, the reason they get away with all of this is because they're given special treatment.
Yeah,
total special treatment.
Anyway,
and ultimately, of course, there will have to be a war, and of course, the Israelis won't necessarily win it, because Hezbollah in Lebanon now have the capacity to take out large chunks of Israeli infrastructure.
As if there will be a war here in this part of the world, if the Israelis carry on like this. I mean, the obvious thing to do if you've got suspect terrorists in Jenin is to send the police in, arrest people and take them to court, not to send the army in and bulldozers into bulldoze. I mean, potentially, of course, there are people in the houses that they've been bulldozing.
Yes.
And that isn't a very good way. It's much better to do things through the courts. Anyway,
if you withdraw from over the green line and dismantle the settlements as you ought to do, we're either going to get a peaceful solution here or we're not.
We're not going to get a peaceful solution.
Because
and actually, it could drag in the Americans and the Chinese into a world war.
Well, yes, and of course the Russian army is based in Syria. The Syrian Arab army still intends to retake the Golan Heights. The original population of the Golan Heights is now being built out by lots of Israeli settlers, and the oil in the Golan Heights is being exploited by foreign conglomerates, including
and in the meantime,
you've got
protests every weekend going on in Tel Aviv of Israelis who are saying we don't want Netanyahu or Naftali Bennett or anybody to have these dictatorial powers.
Well,
they're
against Netanyahu's dictatorial powers
or anybody. They don't want the system changed. Well, anyway, look, we need to make progress through this interview, Martin. We've got a bit more to hear. We've got a bit more to hear in this interview, and these questions are Jana Gadjil. She asks Naftali Bennett, former Prime Minister of Israel, about the international reaction. Does she think that the international community really supports what they're doing in there by sending in the army, when maybe they should be sending in the police and taking suspects through the courts instead?
So let's look at some of the international reaction to action there. So the US, we know, has said Israel has a right to defend itself, but it's also said it's imperative to take all possible precautions to prevent the loss of civilian life. Can you say with assurance that precautions are being taken to prevent the loss of civilian life?
Absolutely.
But we also know that 3,000 people have been forced to leave Jenin. So they fear for their lives.
I can understand that. And fortunately, these 3,000 civilians are not killed temporarily. They left the center of the camp, not Jenin, they left the camp because the camp has become a terror camp and we have to go in, clean up the terror and leave.
Where are those 3,000 people going to go now?
They're going to find a temporary sanctuary in Jenin, 3,000. Look, this is not something we want to do. You're presenting it as if, you know, we enjoy this entering Jenin. I, as a soldier, as a commander, also served in Jenin. I can promise you, no Israeli soldier, no Israeli mom wants to send their boy into Jenin. We do it because we've got no choice, because they are murdering Israelis on the streets. They're stabbing them, shooting them, blowing up on them. And in fact, today, a terrorist came into Tel Aviv and rammed his car deliberately into about 10 civilians. So that's what's going on. This is asymmetric. We're not targeting civilians. They are only targeting civilians.
You say it's something that you don't want to do, but Israeli politicians have been calling this action for some time. And let's just, you also say you want to go in and clean it up. But we know that the Jenin brigades, they may be young, there's many of them, they're disparate, they lack the affiliation of previous organized groups. How can you clean that up?
You're right, it's more complex, but I just want to talk about what you inferred to as the politicians. Make no mistake, I'm not a huge supporter of this government, but I stand behind this government, and all Israelis, left and right, coalition and opposition, stand united behind the security forces of Israel fighting for our own lives. So there's full consensus in Israel that we have to do what we have to do, and then get out of there in order to restore security on the streets of Tel Aviv.
And how long will that take?
As long as it's necessary. I hear reports that it's winding down, but you know, if we need a few more days, let it be. We have to defend our own children. I've got four children. They walk on the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Ra'anana and whatnot, and we got to secure their lives. And if the only way to do it is to go in and hunt down the terrorists who are killing them, so be it.
Naftali Bennett there speaking to the BBC. Martin, all sorts of things come out of that. I mean, he's talking about the attack in Tel Aviv with someone driving into people, a Palestinian apparently. Well, we hear today that the Israeli Defense Force have gone in and killed several people that they believe were responsible for that with the army. I mean, they're obviously not really interested in arresting people or taking them to court anymore. They just send in snatch squads or death squads, really, to kill people who they suspect. So there isn't really any kind of functioning court system. Also, he's saying that what's happening in Israel-Palestine now is asymmetric. Well, the Palestinians are killing civilians, but they're sending the army in to only kill militants.
Well, I mean, that's clearly not the case. More Palestinians have been killed in all of these conflicts than Israelis, and more Palestinian civilians have been killed. So, of course, they want to present it in that way to the outside world, but they're running away from what's fundamental here. If you take over somebody else's country, they have a right in international law to resist you. All of the settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law, and in Israeli law, they are justified as necessary for military reasons. So they are not justified as, you know, they say that we've got to have settlements in the West Bank for military reasons. These are military installations. That means everybody in them is a military target. And of course, in war, lots of civilians get killed. Lots of civilians were killed in Dresden. Now, the problem for the Israelis is that ultimately they're going to run up against people who they won't be able to bully. And that, I suggest, is Hezbollah in Lebanon. And they are preparing, if they do attempt to attack Lebanon, which I think they're going to do, Hezbollah will rain missiles down on Israel. And they ain't seen nothing yet.
Okay, moving on, Martin.
Middle class Israeli voters
we haven't
have
got
to
all
understand
night, yeah.
that their children and their lives are at risk, because that's what wars are like. And if you don't want wars, don't have them.
Moving on to Ukraine, the United States has announced that they will provide Ukraine with cluster bombs. Now, these are illegal munitions. They also, a bit like the depleted uranium, they lie around. They kill people for a long period of time, not quite as long as the depleted uranium, which gets into people's DNA and is passed on to their children. But these cluster bombs are illegal for a reason, aren't they? But the Americans want to, maybe it's that they've got a whole bunch of supplies that have been sitting there in a warehouse that are coming up to their sell-by date.
Yes, and they're not even terribly effective as a weapon. I mean, they were dropping loads of petrol mines in Donetsk some while ago, which are basically just anti-personnel mines, and if you tread on it, it blows your leg off. But that they're just spreading them indiscriminately around, dropping them from the air. Well, it's just desperation on the cusp of madness, isn't it? They're pouring more and more weaponry into an absolutely losing battle.
Well,
and ultimately, we're drifting closer and closer to a nuclear confrontation.
And
at the end of a nuclear confrontation, there will be no state of Israel, but there won't be no state of Britain either.
Ramping things up, Biden has announced that Assad has to go. Remember that from a few years ago, which we were getting every night on the news all the way through from 2010 almost. Assad has to go, Assad has to go, Damascus is about to fall. And Biden says Assad must go again. I don't know why. Obviously, Putin has to go. Quite obviously, President Xi is going to have to go soon as well.
Maybe the Israelis will have to go.
Well, I don't think the Americans will be saying that. United States says Russia is harassing our drones over Syria and that it conducted 37 operations against ISIS in June. So it is very much still in Syria. Apparently, the United States is attacking ISIS. But as we know, many of the commentators have traced back ISIS as basically an American project. So maybe they're just attacking themselves.
Well, they're very, very tricksy. Is what they are. They pretend to be doing something
different. But it gives them a good reason. We've got to stay in Syria to attack ISIS.
By the way, one of the things that was made about
which is another franchise, a different franchise.
Stephen Sarui, I think his name is, was pointing out that a lot of the people leaving Syria is because the war is effectively over and the West has lost in Syria. So they should just lift sanctions on the Assad government and rebuild it. That's what most of the other Arab states have come to the conclusion. This is what we've got to do. So it's quite significant that the Saudis have shifted their position on this because they were determined to remove Assad. But now they've decided that they're going to talk to him and they're going to talk to the Iranians. This is all very, very bad news for the Israelis because everybody's going to gang up on them once we get this peace process in the rest of the Middle East going.
We're going to finish up with a bit of a bang this evening. We'll have a little tiny God slot afterwards, but here he is. This is Kristen Harafson. He's the WikiLeaks editor-in-chief. And he believes at the moment it's the 11th hour for Julian Assange. Julian is likely to be transferred to the United States sometime fairly soon, unless there is some sort of amazing thing. But anyway, I thought I'd ask him originally about who he is, because he's basically taken over Julian Assange's job and he's Icelandic.
My name is Kristin Hrafnsson. I'm the current editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks. I'm an investigative journalist, worked in mostly the broadcasting environment in my home country, Iceland, until 2010, when I joined WikiLeaks. I had met Julian Assange in Reykjavik when he was preparing interesting projects there, and we befriended. He got me on board, and since then I've been part of the WikiLeaks team.
Can you tell me what was it that you liked about WikiLeaks?
Well, my first experience with WikiLeaks was their great service to my home country in relation to the banking crisis of 2008. I had been working, everybody had to become a business journalist at that time and try to figure out what on earth had happened, why our entire economy, not just the banking sector, had collapsed overnight. And, in the months after the crisis, I was working on trying to figure that out through the old-fashioned person-to-person inquiries and trying to get documents and information. I was actually fired from my job when I was close to exposing who the biggest borrower was in the Icelandic banking system, who happened to be a UK individual named Robert Chingis, who was able to borrow billions of pounds out of the Icelandic banks, which he partly owned through a shell company. And it was all siphoned up to BVI companies with little or no collateral. Anyhow, in 2009, this webpage, which I had no information about, never heard of it before, just put out a report, which was the high exposure loans of the biggest banks in Iceland, with their internal estimate of how precarious those loans were, and it was called the Kaupthing leak. It was an explosive news story in Iceland because it showed the irresponsibility of the biggest bank in Iceland, who had a turnover, four times the GDP of the country. And there was an attempt made to take that down, that document. The financial supervisory authorities tried to get a court order, but they couldn't find the headquarters of WikiLeaks. They tried to threaten Julian, who just laughed that off. When I did a story based on that document, it was by that time, I was had rejoined the state television. It was served with an injunction 5 minutes before broadcast, and in a very illustrative way about what WikiLeaks was and capable of, our lovely anchorman came on the set and read the headlines of the news, and then just ad-libbed to the camera and said, these are the news stories that we are allowed to tell you tonight, but just 5 minutes before our broadcast time, we were served an injunction, the first injunction on the news service in Icelandic broadcasting history of 65 years. A report on documents which were published on the website wikileaks.org. Let me repeat, wikileaks.org. And now to the main news. So, obviously caught my interest, and the entire nation was extremely welcoming this information, and it helped the inquiry that was set up to look into the banking crisis, which led to the imprisonment of a lot of the high-profile bankers. Julian was invited to Iceland and stayed there for months in the winter 2009 and 10. But the idea for a country that goes to this meltdown of this transparency through publishing the raw material, the documents, inspired the population of Iceland. It was part of the recovery process to get the actual information. It inspired lawmakers who in 2010 set out an initiative, cross-party, without opposition, of strengthening media laws, which is work still in progress. He did a tremendously good public service. And for me, as somebody who had been in the mainstream media for more than 20 years, this was, and seeing the sort of decline in that environment over the years, getting rather frustrated about the direction of where the mainstream was going. It was such an inspiring new addition to the media environment, and I got was fascinated by the capabilities there, and wanted to know more. And Julian was there, so I sought him out. We became friends, and then he one day we sat down at a cafe on a rainy day in March 2010, and he said, "I got to show you a little video," and flipped over the computer and showed me the collateral murder video, and rest is history.
What you're implying there is that maybe this prosecution from the United States under the Espionage Act to do with military leaks, it may be more to the prosecution of Julian than just that.
Well, if you look at what has been published and the reaction to the publications, it's not just the exposure of the military document. It's an expose of much deeper elements. You know, you're instantly flagged as a conspiratorial individual if you talk about the deep state, and if you even talk about conspiracy, you're a conspiracy theorist. I mean, that term has been totally destroyed, even though a conspiracy is a very active thing and is part of the legal language. I mean, anyhow, there are deeper forces there. There were banking documents released prior to that leaks in 2010 and 11. Wrongdoing in the corporate sector as well, Bank of Julius Baer, etc. It is across the board, and it was come as no wonder to us that when the first sort of strong reaction that we got from the U.S. in 2010, as a reaction to the military document expose and the diplomatic cables, was a concentrated reaction by the biggest powerhouses in international banking, putting a banking blockade on WikiLeaks and trying to starve the entire funds. We were receiving ever-growing massive funds through small donations from individuals all around the world, and the big powerhouses, MasterCard and Visa, with Bank of America, with forces in European banking, all teamed together putting a blockade and trying to starve the oxygen flow to the organization, which actually put us in a lot of trouble. And we actually resisted, pushed back, and were able through a discovery process, for example, when we were attempting to get Visa and MasterCard investigated on antitrust basis in the European Union, that this was politically instigated. They had to admit that the heads of the U.S. Intelligence Committee in the Senate and in the House, in the Congress, were in contacting these banking institutions and putting pressure on them to react. So it was, we saw that ugly face of that side of power as well.
So more recently, the struggle to keep Julian in the UK, I mean, it's been so horrific for him, particularly because it's almost like an extension of a sentence that hasn't even been passed yet. What stage is that at? Because I know that there's just been a failure to succeed in an appeal. So can you just tell us where we are with all this?
Well, we are very close to a point of no return. It's 11th hour, so to speak. The High Court just weeks ago, decided, one judge in the High Court, that to deny Julian appeal in the High, to the High Court. He has only one avenue left, that is to repeat that process and request another hearing on the request to appeal. And then it will go to two High Court judges in an oral hearing. We have no idea when that's going to happen. If that is denied, he is extradited. That is the end of the road in the UK. If High Court judges, those three, one has already done it, and the other two will deny him an appeal, it cannot be brought to the Supreme Court. That's the end of the road. And there's already a signed a document from the Home Office to extradite him and throw him on a rendition plane to the US.
So the process, legal process, does seem to be very, very flawed. I'm wondering if, in a nutshell, you can explain why he is even being prosecuted under the Espionage Act, where certainly on the face of it, it looks as if it was the newspapers themselves that released this information, not Julian and not WikiLeaks. That WikiLeaks and Julian took great pains not to release this sensitive information.
Yeah, I mean, the so-called judicial process here in the UK has only revealed one thing, that the entire system is rotten to the core, and it's a systemic corruption. And it's become extremely revealing for me, from as an outsider, to sit in all the court proceedings and see this happening in front of your eyes. It's just an eye-opening experience to see the length of stretching the law by circumventing the law in an attempt to service the Americans in this extradition process. It is such an obvious politicized process, and he is a political prisoner, and everybody sees that now, that he's a political prisoner here in the United Kingdom. The indictment in the United States, which was brought about under Trump, was the first time a journalist and a publisher is hit with an indictment based on the Espionage Act. There is 17 of those. The 18th count is a ridiculous one, where he is charged with breaching Computer Intrusion Act. They call it the hacking charge, even there is not even the description of any hacking in the indictment, but that's propaganda by the Department of Justice. These could land him in a prison for 175 years in the United States. This is a foregone conclusion if he's extradited, because this will go before a court in the Eastern District of Virginia, where the jury pool is almost entirely picked from people with vested interest in all the government institutions that are within a circle of, you know, what, 40, 50 miles, you know, including the CIA, State Department, and what have you. One statistic, which is very informative about so-called justice in that court, that it's rather unfavorable, against the defendant, the conviction rate, because in espionage cases in that court, it is 100% conviction rate, which should tell you a little bit of story of what kind of justice is to be had. And that's why the authorities there, the Department of Justice, brings espionage cases to this particular court. It's called the spy court. It's where you formally just finish the case. But he will be thrown into detention upon arrival to the U.S., and they can drag on the pre-trial period up to 3 years, and we know for a fact that he would be held in solitary confinement, and I'm afraid that he would not survive that, and that is the medical assessment that has not been contradicted in courts here in the United Kingdom, that he is in grave danger and his life is in danger if he is extradited into those conditions.
Well, it's interesting that we've got a general election coming up soon here in the UK. The leader of the opposition, it looks likely to become the next Prime Minister, is Keir Starmer. He had a role, didn't he, as a prosecutor, the DPP here in the UK, before he became an MP. And it does look as if it's been revealed recently that there's quite a close relationship between this potential new Prime Minister in Britain and the Department for Justice in the United States and the State Department. This has only just recently come out.
Well, there have been writings and investigation, a journalist writing on this subject that whilst Keir Starmer was DPP and head of the Crown Prosecution Service, he curated and established a really close connection to the Department of Justice in the United States and the State Department, and a much closer than the DPP had ever had before. And of course, Sir Keir was head of the Crown Prosecuting Service when the CPS was actively, as you know, from information that were obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests, delaying the process of the Swedish case, keeping that in limbo, keeping that in from forwarding, directing strongly the Swedes not to progress the case, to keep Julian locked up in the embassy for as long as possible. That all came from an official in the CPS. We have now through evidence of it in email, so even though they are redacted somewhat, we can easily read that. And the journalist who obtained these documents, Stefania Murici, an investigative journalist, also got data from the Swedish side. So if you pull that together, you can see exactly what the scenario was all about. The Swedish wanted to close the case as early as 2012-13 and said so in emails. But then the Crown Prosecuting Service, which was supposedly just to have a role to us servicing the Swedes, well, we're writing back and say, don't you dare to get cold feet on us.
No, I'm sure Starmer would say, were he here. He said, this is nothing to do with me. I was director of the service, but I wasn't managing this case.
Oh, it is well known, and I mean, there have been reports on that in that scenario, in that time, Keir Starmer wanted all high-profile cases to pass by his desk. That is, you can read that in the book The Starmer Project by the journalist Oliver Eagleton, where he's based his findings on interviewing former colleagues of Keir Starmer at the Crown Prosecuting Service. And it is hard to think that he would not know such a high-profile case, how it was being directed and indeed manipulated. And now there's an ongoing inquest. Now, it hasn't been in the news that An information tribunal has ordered an inquest into the fact that thousands of emails pertaining to Julian Assange have been destroyed at the Crown Prosecution Service, totally against all regulations. And actually, it should be a criminality, because these documents and the communications were destroyed while the case was still open. Who can destroy documents on a pending case? What on earth was in these documents?
Well, it sounds to me like perversion of the course of justice, which can lead to up to life imprisonment potentially, because these are the sorts of documents which Julian's lawyers may be requesting or even forcing through the courts to be disclosed in court.
Absolutely. And this is just one of the dozens of angles of how abusive the entire process has been when it comes to Julian. It's on all fronts, on all levels. Wherever you dive into the case, you see abuse on that. And no wonder that Nils Melzer, the former special rapporteur on torture at the United Nations, who investigated the case of Julian Assange and wrote a book about it, he came to the conclusion there was no parallel. You cannot find no other example in the Western world where four countries on all level have teamed up in such a mobbing effort towards one individual. And that's Ecuador, Sweden, United Kingdom and the United States on all level, and of course including with participation in the media in this smear campaign against Julian Assange.
Well, this makes all those four countries, particularly the British, look very, very bad internationally, and it gives all of Britain's contestants around the world a very easy get-out when it comes to human rights. They will say, well, what about human rights with you, and what about Julian Assange? So what's the point of it all?
The point of it all in silencing Julian is sending an clear example and making a sample out of him to have the cooling effect that you don't mess with our secrets. We will not allow it. This is the limit. You've overstepped, and it has already had a chilling effect. It's obvious. We have seen the example throughout the years in the 13 years that we've been fighting for the freedom of Julian. This has empowered other nations in their attack on journalism. You had even raids in his home country in Australia, where they raided the public broadcaster, the ABC, and took out computers in attempt to try to locate a source for a story. You had all these events going on all over the place. Even Bolsonaro got the idea to try to go after Glenn Greenwald based on the indictment against Julian. And on another level, you have given the excuse of others, other leaders, to crack down on journalists. I mean, even Gerskovich is one who is now being imprisoned in Moscow in Levenfurto prison, accused of espionage, the first one Western journalist to be imprisoned after the end of the Cold War. And on top of that, you have the damage on that front is already clear. And the cooling effect in our part of the world, if you may say so, is already obvious as well.
There seems to have been a change in character in the Guardian Observer newspaper. The foreign reporting, for example, in this newspaper seems to be very much more pro the Anglo-American Empire establishment than it was before the days when they were publishing leaks from Julian himself.
Yeah, I mean, that's an all. We can have a long discussion about my observation of the British media, and it's not going to be a very, very generous remarks that I will make about the process there. And I'm afraid, especially when it comes to The Guardian, they have. I have no praise for their reporting in the chains. But this is a part of a larger picture, and a troubling picture indeed. And the New York Times, for example, has been awful when it comes to the processing information. And it's not the New York Times that that took on the establishment, for example, in the early 70s when it came to the Pentagon Papers. It's not the Washington Post of that era. The entire mainstream media environment has totally changed and shifted, and not in the right direction, and the opposite.
So, Lou, isn't there some hope for Julian if he does get extradited to the United States? Because if you look at, for example, the Espionage Act prosecution of Chelsea Manning, when it actually came to it, the sentence was much less than had been originally threatened, and also he's now done deals and he's out of prison.
Well, he didn't do any deals. He was... her sentence was commuted by Obama when he was on his way out of the White House, probably because of bad conscience and probably of legacy concerns, because he campaigned on a promise to create avenues and safeguard the very positive practice of whistleblowing. And you have all these campaign videos before the 2008 election when he was praising whistleblowers for the good work, and they were, a whistleblower was absolutely very important in the democratic process. But lo and behold, under his presidency, he imprisoned more whistleblowers than all presidents, under the Espionage Act, than all presidents combined since the act was put in place in 1917. So I think it was bad conscience that led to him commuting Chelsea Manning's sentence. But she did spend 7 years in prison, and she was imprisoned again when they were trying to pressure her into witnessing against Julian Assange. But she did get 35 years imprisonment in the military court. I don't think even Julian Assange would get that kind of sentence. It would probably be more, because the forces that are against him are so ferocious, and it's not even a given thing that the Biden administration, the political top layer, has the power to actually intervene at the moment.
I think it's fair to say that there are forces around the world very pro-Julian too, though. And also, of course, the whole concept of WikiLeaks is a very powerful one still.
It is a powerful idea, and it still lives on. The legacy of it is being attacked, and it is an ongoing one, but that will not be successful. The support for Julian is tremendously growing. It's big and it's growing. And I've met five presidents in Latin America, including the Obrador president of Mexico and Lula da Silva in Brazil. And all the countries south of the United States borders, all the most important states there, now have basically an official policy supporting Julian. And in Brazil, it's part of the foreign policy of the country to fight for Julian. People see the implication that if this goes ahead. You know, I addressed the Human Rights Commission in the Senate in Brazil. They passed a resolution. So on all levels in Latin America, it's full support. And now... the Pope did see Stella Assange, and in that way sent a clear signal of support without him saying anything. But the sheer fact that he would invite her to come with their two sons to the Vatican is quite obviously a signal of understanding that this is absolutely a gross violation on all front.
So is WikiLeaks still able to do what it used to do? Say someone comes to you with a flash drive with some sensitive information?
We are operational, but we have been focusing all our effort to the most important project of our mind, that is to save Julian and thereby save our own skin, so to speak, and the idea of journalism, because this is Julian Assange's case is the most precarious threat, an existential threat to investigative journalism in the world today.
Okay, could you just tell us whereabouts to find, where if listeners want to contribute to the campaign, what's the best way to do it?
Look up Don't Extradite Assange campaign webpage. A lot of information is there, and ideas to how to support, and the Twitter feeds of the Don't Extradite Assange campaign and the WikiLeaks Twitter. It's easy to find information on the subject, and I urge people to actually get familiar with it, because there's themselves without intermediaries, because we have had unfavorable media. But when you get on down that path, it will be a huge revelation, not just about Julian Assange, but about the sort of the increased darkness that is descending upon us in this part of the world, and in the world in at large. You can call it the power of fascism or whatever, but it's power of darkness that is descending upon us. And Julian's case is very much a symptomatic of what that is bringing to us.
Obviously, the fight needs money, it needs resources. You talked about how the banking establishment turned on WikiLeaks. Is it still possible to donate?
It is. And actually, it was one of the success in courts that we had. We took a Visa affiliate to court, and we were able to crush the banking blockade, which was a great success, and we actually could claim compensation for the wrongdoing. There was success when in other court cases where there was an attempt to take down information in California, for example. There was success in one of the most unreported story in judicial history of the United States, even though it should have been high profile. The Democratic National Committee tried to take Julian Assange to court. And in a very humiliating way, a federal court judge in Manhattan dismissed the case with prejudice. Anybody who reads that document, and I hope more Americans would actually do that, should be surprised that you could find a voice of that nature. The judge said, and this was about revelation in the 2016 trial prior to the election there, the DNC leaks and the Podesta leaks, that Julian Assange did was clearly a journalistic practice protected by the U.S. First Amendment, and it was not a crime to reveal the wrongdoing of a political party or a questionable political party prior to the election. It was in the public interest, and case dismissed. Of course, it was none of the legacy media in the United States report on it. You could never find a single report on that remarkable judgment.
Kristen Harafenson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So that's the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Kristen Harafenson, talking to me this week. I think absolutely so much in there, so much, particularly the amazing support there is in Latin America for this. And you know, you basically just got a handful of despotic, clique-run, Bilderberg-related governments that seem to be going for Julian. And one of the most fascinating things there, of course, was the link to the Icelandic jailing of bankers in 2009 and 2010, which is when the Americans launched their, you know, isn't that an interesting, I found this fascinating chatting with him, because you got such an insight into the potential that actually none of this is to do with the military leaks that Julian has done at all, which is what he's being tried for. So brilliant. Thank you so much, Christian. And also, of course, ongoing support for Julian and his campaign. Lovely to hear that the Pope has seen Stella Assange, is sending a very strong message there. And also in the United States, there's a fascinating report I saw on antiwar.com this week saying disaffected journalists are rejecting FBI requests to aid the prosecution. So US prosecutors have quite a struggle ahead if they hope to convince journalists frustrated with Assange's behaviour to aid them in their attack on freedom of the press. Three journalists who worked with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange have been approached by the FBI, US Justice Department, to testify against him. Each one have had a falling out with Assange, but they've made it clear they will not help prosecutors bolster their case. The whole world's against you guys, and you're painting yourself into the corner, not only internationally, but with your own populations as well. So don't think we don't know what you're up to. Finally this week, going to hear a little bit from Laura Dodsworth, the author of State of Fear. I think it was her... She did a book all about the sort of draconian measures of the lockdowns, but here she is talking about her attempt to find the church, because this is something that she's decided that she wants to try and do, because it's the way that the society is going has reawakened her the same obviously with me, you know, an interest in the Bible, interest in the church and things spiritual, to see the way that the governments around us seem to be turning evil.
When times are hard, when everything's going mad, when there are lots of struggles and some people are working out how to balance their books every month, well, you can turn to God.
Yes.
So I decided this year I would go to church more.
Okay.
Because it was a kind of a question of walking the talk. After writing A State of Fear, which gave me something of an existential crisis about human psychology.
Right.
You know, seeing in our time how people were whipped up using propaganda and fear to comply with draconian laws.
Yeah.
And then writing my next book, Free Your Mind, which is all about how you resist manipulation, they keep bringing me back to what you can do as an individual to have a strong sense of values, to get spiritual nourishment, to do things that provide more stability for society. So I thought, well, I'm going to try this.
Right.
I'm going to try going back to church. Mm-hmm. It's been a long time since my C of E school.
Yes. And did you go regularly to church when you were a child?
Well, I went to C of E school, and
it's not the same thing. Break it to you.
No, normal things like Easter, Christmas, not every Sunday.
So you didn't go every Sunday?
No.
See, I was an altar boy.
Were you?
Good Catholic boy. Every Sunday. Sometimes Saturdays, weddings.
Really? You
know, Stations of the Cross, the whole nine yards.
Photos, or it's not real. Photos next week, please, of Mike as an altar boy.
No, we had pictures in those days.
We didn't have a camera. You couldn't afford a kebab. You certainly couldn't afford a camera.
I tried to buy a camera once, and my father wouldn't let me get it on hire purchase, which was the only way I could afford to get it. He said you have to save up for it.
That's the good old days when you weren't allowed to borrow money.
Yeah.
I say that to my sons all the time. My youngest is always saying, can I have a tenner? I'll pay you back when I'm paid.
Yeah.
I'm like, No. Learn to manage your money, sunshine.
Really?
He thinks I'm horrible.
Yeah, but I get the call in the middle of the night to say, I can't get home, I need to get a taxi, I haven't got any money. So you haven't got any choice, really, at that point.
Use your legs. Buy a kebab with the loose change in your
pocket.
You can't
always do that in the countryside, though.
Back to church.
Anyway, sorry,
back to church. Gosh, we've learned about Mike the altar boy, Mike the Day of the Triffid resident, and Kabul Kebab.
Yeah.
Kabul Kebab
is great.
This sounds like a new program.
That could be a new TV show.
Kabul Kebab. I'm TMing that.
Very good.
Okay. So back to church. Well, what I found since looking into the church again more and getting its daily news and going to church is I feel like the Church of England, it's debatable really whether it worships God or net zero. It's obsessed with climate.
Is it?
Sometimes going to a sermon is like woke bingo.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well, this is all led by the Archbishop of Wokebury, isn't it?
It is. I mean, he's particularly... COP27, he made quite a rousing fire and brimstone speech about flooding.
Right.
And that set me off on a little journey. I thought, well, okay, there are floods which cause trauma, death, devastation. They may or may not be anthropogenic. I looked at the IPCC information on that. It's not really very clear. Some might be, some might not be. Oh, gosh, so what's happening with flooding in this country? Here's the Archbishop of the Church of England, after all. And I've got the figures here because I contacted the ONS about it. And it's not the only point to make about his COP26 speech, but it's just something that struck me. One death has been registered as caused by flooding in England and Wales between 2013 and 2021.
One?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Registered as caused by flooding.
8 years?
Yeah. There might be others, but they weren't registered as caused by flooding. They maybe they died later of other causes or something. There were, however, 4,859 deaths related to drug poisoning in England and Wales in 2021.
Right.
And it's just one of those things that strikes me. I mean, you never really hear the Church of England talking about drug problems.
No.
And I've got teenage boys. I know you've got teenagers. You must be exposed, just as I am, to how many drugs young people are doing.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, why aren't they talking about that?
And then it's not fashionable.
Well, it's not about climate, is it? And then there's another one. The Museum of Homelessness charity found that the number of homeless people that died in 2022 was 1,313, which was an 85% increase on the study 3 years before. So we've got all these people dying on the streets and dying from drugs. And I can't find the Archbishop of Canterbury talking about that.
No.
He's banging on about floods.
Well, it's like when he bangs on about migrants and Tories, and he doesn't actually say that the Archbishop would have in his power the ability to devote huge swathes of land that the church owns in parts of the country where they could build houses and put them all in them. They didn't do any of that.
I just found something about it rankles, and it feels unfair and difficult, because in two areas, drug dependency and addiction and homelessness, where you think the church might be able to really offer spiritual nourishment, guidance,
seems
and
like
where
a Christian
that
thing
might
to do.
And it might make sense for political direction. Instead, its focus is unremittingly on net zero. I mean, another example was at Lent, there were talks that people could give up meat, have meat-free Fridays, not for the reasons they used to, which would be to mirror when Jesus
fish on a Friday was definitely a staple of my childhood.
Yeah, but that was about Jesus going into the desert for 40 days. That's what Lent's about. It wasn't about the sacrifice Jesus made. No, it's for climate. Mm. As though you can change the purpose of something which has got, you know, thousands of years old tradition for something which is a brand new human concern that you can just switch one
well,
practice
Ireland,
for another.
They're talking about slaughtering hundreds of hundreds of livestock for the climate, to save the climate. It's nice, isn't it?
No, it's not nice.
No, I know. I didn't think it was nice.
So I'm finding at the moment that just when I've had something of a little bit of a road to Damascus moment, the church has had a road to Davos moment.
Yeah.
And just at the time when I'm interested in the structure that church might provide, I feel like the structure is quite hollow, like an empty vessel, and it doesn't really know what it's about anymore.
Oh.
Anyway, my latest Substack's about my experience of the Church of England.
Yes. Mick says this, Laura laughs, but I remember living on mince tatty soup, no lino, no TV, and only one car in the village in the 60s. It's true. It's absolutely true.
So that's the People's Republic of Mike Graham there on Talk Radio, discussing the wisdom or otherwise of, I think he calls him now Archbishop Wokeby, is what he calls. But also, Laura Dodsworth having a similar experience to me, going along to the Church of England and finding that some of the sermons rather hollow. You know, I think it all depends on, you know, the individual vicar. Sometimes there's someone that doesn't really seem to have anything much to say. It's just kind of teach, almost like a sermon that is designed for five-year-olds being preached in the parish. But then I guess that's just going the way of all flesh, isn't it? Slowly but surely, these institutions are just taken over by the other side, the dark side. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest. That's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, as well, of course, to Christian Harafson from WikiLeaks. A great long piece there, but fascinating insight too. And to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. One little last thing, though. We must read out a poem from Patricia Opulenza this week, an ode to Janine. When is a choice not a choice? When you are driven out and have no voice, or told, stay, a citizen without state either way, or resist, crushed to death with hate and loathing. Every day, pray tell, if you can, or say, when it became au fait to kill and maim. Where people walk and children play, clear the path, clear the route, get them out, give them the boot. Or rights and wrongs, who dare say, when it became okay to kill and maim where people live and children play. Thanks very much, Patricia. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored. That's the Telegram channel. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. And you can subscribe to my weekly email list there too, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I've got two paperback books. One is The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers, which is looking at the links between the Nazis and the Brits before the end of the Second World War and afterwards, of course. And also The Siege of Heaven Reader, paperback two, which is secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday breakfast at camberleysradioquk.com, that is to say talkradio.org.uk. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol. Just below us, they're just starting the People's Comedy, which is this I suppose you might just call left-wing comedy. It's a kind of anti-establishment comedy night they have once a month. That is actually physically here, just off Jamaica Street in Bristol, once a month. I believe it is on a Friday. Talkradio.org.uk stream is what you've been listening to, and at radioqk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Thank you. green and buzzing in his dungeon of despair. An evil prince eats a steaming pig in a chamber right near there. He eats the snouts and the trotters first. The loins and the groins is soon dispersed. His carving style is well rehearsed. He stands and shouts. All men be cursed. All men be cursed. All men be cursed. All men be cursed. And disagree. Well, no one durst. He's the best, of course, of all the worst.
All green and buzzing in his dungeon of despair. Who are all those people that is locked away down there? Are they crazy? Are they sainted? Someone painted. It has never been explained since at first it was created. But a dungeon like a sin requires not but locking in of everything that's ever been. Look at her.